Australian Survivor.
Survivor New Zealand.
Survivor.
21 South Africans.
12 ordinary Australians.
16 New Zealanders.
20 federal.
£1 million.
Million euro.
Million
shekels. 1 million rubli.
Tribe spoke.
Scheibe trocken.
Ship.
Hello everyone and welcome to RATP's coverage of Survivor Global for Winners at War. I'm your host Shannon Gus, here to talk about episode 3. How fun is Winners at War? What did we do to deserve this? Every time I ask that, I actually do remember about 2019 Survivor and then I remind myself what I did, but this is great. This is a great reward for all of us long-suffering US Survivor fans because Winners at War is that good. Honestly, I'm so hyped up still. And to talk about episode 3, kind of delve into what we've been seeing, I have a great guest who I think will match my enthusiasm for the series, and that is an all-around fun character and great human being from Survivor South Africa Island of Secrets. Please welcome Mike Fenter.
Hello, Shannon. How are you, friend?
I'm clearly hyped up. I feel very good about what we're watching.
Yeah, I feel really bad because every time a vote out happens, you get inboxed by me so many times over because I'm just upset about it. Like, it's great to watch and I love every moment of the season except for the vote reading because it's just broken my heart the 4 times it's happened thus far. Because in South Africa, yeah, we don't get Winners at War on any of our broadcasters. So I've got no one to really message immediately because I'm afraid I spoiled it for them. So it's you and then it's Mike and then it's LaRue about 5 hours afterwards once I'm sure he's watched it and you just get lambasted with all my unhappiness from the episode.
Yeah, well, okay, this was pretty devastating. Like, look, Nat took it out of me. She was one of my faves. You know, Amber, it was cool to see her come back, but like compared to Kim, I was okay with it. Danny, another one, it was cool to see it, but that was fine. But Ethan, oh my God, like this was really, really crushing. And the thing is that's really interesting is that it was hard for me to rank my favorites preseason, but I think the way I'm going to be able to rank them is like to rank the devastation. Like with preseason, I might have told you that Nat was slightly above Ethan, but I think I was more upset about Ethan. So now I know. And that's a good way to be able to tell how much I love these people in order.
Well, I was really upset about Amber leaving because Amber, to me, represented a golden era of my Survivor viewing where I knew nothing about tactics. I just liked the idea of Survivor where like people were on an island and were starving and were eating bugs and stuff. And she represents that in many ways because I so clearly remember watching All-Stars as like a young kid, a pre-primary school child.
Yeah, I was going to ask, are you born when Amber played?
Engaged. I was 3 years old when Amber played the Australian Outback. Mm-hmm. And then to be able to watch Ethan in the same way, like Ethan was my favorite from Africa. And it's now gotten to a point where I've played Survivor myself and I could re-watch them playing live. It was a really rich experience. So for both those two people, and Amber as well, like it was just devastating for me because I was so excited by it. And I was hoping for them as people, they seem like really, really good people. And they would be able to fulfill this big hope and expectation and would be able to translate, all this preparation into a really good game. And it didn't happen that way. And it was very upsetting for me to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, the Amber and Rob thing, I agree. Like, I remember them getting engaged. It must have been 10 years old, like, just after I'd started watching in Pearl Islands. And that they were, like, the couple of my childhood. And then watched them in The Amazing Race. Like, they were the Brangelina of my world, which was Survivor. Yeah. And I like seeing them back again. Like, even though she went home, I still think getting them back on the same season is cool. I got chills last episode when Rob got the token and kind of realized what it meant. That's cool. And I feel like, even though I was upset to see her go, it felt like it had meaning because it was obvious that she was getting outplayed and that the game had surpassed her. And, like, that's interesting to see in and of itself. Whereas, like, with Ethan, I don't feel that. It does feel more random. I feel like he didn't go through anything of his own doing. It was more just, like, being part of the old schoolers. So I don't love that as much because I can't assign as much meaning to it. So I'm like, well, what was the point? I've waited 15 years to see him back. He's gone through, everything. He's the most inspirational person, always has been on Survivor. We get him back for 4 episodes. Like, I feel like I am hard done by.
I completely agree with you, but I think what's interesting about Ethan is that oftentimes when you see Survivor fans' feedback to players leaving, there's a lot of vitriol. Like, most of the people who watch Survivor are going to be unhappy with many characters. It's very rare that you find someone who enjoys everyone in a season. I think you are one person who always gives, like, everyone the benefit of the doubt, and you seem to enjoy every character in many complex and varying ways. That's I think nice. For the average person like me, like a simpleton, I get really into some people and I get really out of some people. And Ethan just seems so universally loved. I don't think I've seen anyone sort of like celebrate the fact that Ethan was voted out, which is a real anomaly and a real testament to his character and his person, that people are just so devastated that he's leaving, because he was so fun to watch. It was nostalgic in some way, because you thought back to when Survivor didn't even broadcast the tactics that were spoken about before Tribal, because that was the nature of the game, or a survival game. And he won a season under those circumstances, an inland season. You know, it's wild to think about that now. And so the nostalgia factor was there, but also he was just so cool to watch in the season. Like, he was having a good time. Mm-hmm. He was focusing on having fun rather than like trying to play the game too hard. He approached it as best as I thought he would possibly approach it. And honestly, he was one of my winner picks. I was like, this guy is in a perfect position. He's friendly, he's likable, and he's under the radar. So I think he's smart enough to find a way to get very deep in the game. And when that vote happened, because it's kind of predictable now when you read the voting sequences. I'm sure you can do the same, where you kind of like, okay, so the first person to be read is probably safe, and there'll be a decoy second. And then if there's a third person mentioned in the voting, oftentimes that's the person who's going to be voted out. And when I saw Adam being voted for, I was like, okay, I'm cool with this. And the second I saw that Ethan vote, my heart just sank. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, how did this happen? What has gone on? Why?
Yes, you perfectly summed up our emotions. Like, look, Ethan, I didn't think he could win, because I thought he was too threatening. You know, just the fact that, like, he would definitely get the money at the end. But I never saw him going this early. And again, I don't really feel like it's his fault. I feel like it's much more a circumstantial thing. You know, even Zon as a person, as a concept, has always transcended Survivor. Like, I relished last night talking about him with my in-laws, because they were like, well, what is this charity and everything? And I was like, the story is amazing. Like, that he had this charity that he created because of a reward that he went on, that he mentioned in his final tribal council speech. Like, we were all part of that history. And what he's done for the world, and then what he's gone through personally, is just more than most people. He is honestly, like, that's why he's like a figure in the Survivor community. And like, again, the nostalgia, the reverence, it's all there. He really is just a legend of the game, but not even like a legend like Sandra and Boston Rob, who will pop up every few seasons, a legend that we really didn't think we'd ever get to see play again. And then he came back and it was a miracle. Like, I think Absolutely. He was one of the biggest surprises in the cast. And then we got it for 4 episodes. We'll talk about Age of Extinction. I don't personally count it so much. Maybe he will come back, but that is why it's just so unbelievably heartbreaking. But it's going to be with this cast, because Ethan, probably the nicest, kindest person to ever play. Yul Kwon, probably the smartest. Tony, probably the craziest. Poverty, you know, that all of these people are the somethingest of Survivor. So losing them, well, most of them are. So losing them is going to be painful, but we really felt with Ethan. This was maybe the biggest heartbreak communally yet. And that is saying something, because everyone brings something.
It's actually such an important thing to note. You mentioned all these iconic characters in the context of Survivor generally. And it's something that we need to be aware of as Survivor fans. Like, it will probably never get this good again. I don't think it will ever be as good as it is right now.
I agree.
I don't think we'll ever see a situation where we have the range of superstars that we have right now. Even if you make a so-called legend season, yes, I would love to see Russell Hans play again, because I love Russell. He's hilarious. I would love to see like Fabio back again, because I thought Fabio was like such a, he would look hilarious playing with all these like really intelligent, really maneuvering characters. I think it'd be really funny to watch. But in terms of like a Survivor season, I don't think we'll ever see anything like this again. I think this will be the biggest we'll ever see. And I'm okay with that. It's important to be aware of it when we're watching. Like, every single moment you need to indulge in and drink it in, because it's hard to imagine we'll ever get this good ever again.
Yeah, and I hope Survivor goes on forever, and it's just like, as I've said, like a sport. I mean, I've been, you know, AFL's been on the air for, you know, hundreds of years, and that's what it should be. It should be a sport. But in terms of like this era, the fact that we've been watching this for 20 years and someone like Ethan can come back from 2001 and Amber and all of these players that, you know, you have the marquee players, but you also have the players you didn't think you would get, that you have reverence for, these legends. Like, I do think that this is you know, the Avengers of this era of Survivors, it will move on. But absolutely. Then you have someone like Sandra saying, I'm retiring after this. When you hear something like that, it hits home that this is the end of an era, even though the show will go on. And in hopefully 20 years from now, we'll have players we don't even know right now. We'll have another legend season of players we've never even met, which is crazy to think. But for this era, for the history of the show that we've been in, this really is the end of something, and it's so iconic, and it's crazy we get to talk about it. Like, I feel so happy to be alive, right? Look around at how lucky we are to be alive right now during Survivor Winners at War.
Yeah. The fact that you have an opinion to give on the season is an intense privilege, and it's something that obviously I'm so thankful for, because you know, it's a year and a half ago, I had no context in the Survivor community, and I would have dreamed about a season like this. But now that I get to speak about it with some level of experience and some level of authority, even though it's a muted level of authority, it's still an intense privilege. So yeah, I think credit must go to CBS and Survivor. You know, we've given them a hard time oftentimes for many things over the years, and like Jeff Probst gets lots of heat on social media all the time, but so far in this season, I really can't complain about anything. I think the editing's been spectacular. I think the storytelling has been good. I think there's been a nice mix of being aware of what was going on at Tribal Council, but also a nice element of surprise at moments. I think the Ethan vote was a bit of a shock, and sometimes that is not that useful when you can't tell why things are happening. But even though this was a blindside to the audience, we can still perfectly trace the reasoning behind it. You know, sometimes, like with Chelsea last season, I didn't really get why she was voted out. This time around, I think it's been quite clear that even though I've been blindsided in the last episode and in the first episode too, it's nice to know that there is a logical, coherent story as to why these things happened the way it did happen.
I completely agree about the editing. I think it's been really, really good. If you look at the confessional chart, quite consistent. And, you know, I'm obviously watching Australian Survivor at the same time, and Australian Survivor is not consistent in its editing. You have people with 90 confessionals compared to people with under 10, and I'm not even joking, that is the disparity. And something that really crystallized for me was watching the ladder scene last week, which I genuinely think is one of the best scenes in Survivor history. It's one of my favorite scenes ever. It's so good and it's so funny, but I think if it was in Australian Survivor's hands, it would all be narrated by Tony. But because of the great cast and how many brilliant perspectives they have to draw from, and because of the editing style of the season, you hear from Wendell, you hear from Sophie, you hear a little bit from Yule. I don't think that's as much in confessional, but he's talking as well. You obviously hear from Tyson with his funny confessionals, then it goes on to a scene with Sarah, and you've heard from Tony at the beginning. That's most of the cast, and we're getting character beats from all of them. So even though they have so much less time, we do obviously know these people, but we do feel like we're relearning them because they're pretty much all around. Obviously, you know, less from Dekal, who haven't been losing, but I do feel like we are getting these character beats, and it's so stark the difference compared to Australian Survivor, because genuinely just Tony would have narrated that. And while that's great TV, because Tony, much like the main characters of Australian Survivor, are great narrators and great TV, I think it is more important to let us get to know or get to re-know these players, and the editing, I think, has been really, really brilliant in that regard with a very limited amount of time.
Yeah, I think the next thing to note is how Survivor have managed to use the experience to make something quite spectacular. So it's similar in radio. Sometimes we can't air things that are too long because it will lose the attention of a passive listener. So
you've got to make things really short.
But certainly, you know, on broadcast radio, it's something that we need to do. So sometimes you'll have a 10-minute interview that you think is full of like really good content, but you have to put that up online and then refer listeners to that online resource to try and make sense of the full thing. And I think that there's a duty on Survivor fans right now. If you consider yourself to be a fan, if you're invested in the story, if you care about these characters, duty now exists for you to, once the episode airs, go online and watch the secret scenes, because they're there for a reason. You know, they're important beats in the overall story. I mean, and they're fun to watch. They might not be like the most breakneck content in the world, but certainly there's lots to be gauged from them. I think if you to see the last episode with Tyson going to the beauty salon, hilarious. Like, it's so fun to watch that. But there was an important thing I noticed was, you know, Kim, we've been fed the idea that she might be a bit isolated. And even there, she doesn't seem to be in a really great place with the tribe, because she's kind of with them for a moment. Sarah talks over her for a second. In the next frame, she's out of the shot. So it makes you then think, is Kim's situation on the island improving? Is she making headway? From that scene, perhaps not. You know, perhaps she's trying hard, but it's not really working out for her as yet. So I would like to reiterate that for Survivor fans at this point, the content is online for you to refer to, and it's a good thing to do it. If you're watching Winners at War right now, there's a very good chance you have access to the internet. Take the time, go look at their scenes, infer what you can from them, because they add lots of layers to the story, and unfortunately there's only so much time the episode can have, but their secret scenes help bridge those gaps. And this comes from our own experience, where I found that in the first 3 days of Island of Secrets, there was a massive default in the edit about how much rain there was. Like, I couldn't make sense of how much rain there was on the island. It rained just incessantly for the first like 8 days, and it wouldn't stop at all. And I was hard for me to make sense of the fact that the episode couldn't really air that to everyone. And a few days later, a secret scene appeared of basically a couple of confessionals about the rain, where we heard from Leanne, we heard from Dura, we heard from me talking about this incredible rain and showing my like old man hands, because they'd been sort of washed away by the rain. Those beats are important, and they add lots of context to the season, so it's a good thing to hit online and to see the secret scenes, because they are as good as the on-air episode. It's just that there's less time to put the secret scenes in.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of all the Winners at War content, literally just hook it to my vades. It's harder as an international to find all the secret scenes, but like Reddit will help you out. They're so good. You had Parvati teaching Ethan to lie. Ethan also put up a great scene about like what this experience means to him, which really did make the vote out somehow even more heartbreaking, if that was possible. It is so, so good, and I agree. Like, they don't have as much time, and as we've said, you know, they're on prime time. They just have that hour. All the casuals are probably happy with that, because this isn't like the marquee event of their lives like the rest of us. So, yeah, I mean, there is that extra content there, and I definitely implore, obviously, everyone to be looking at it, because it's so fun. And as you said, in its own way, it's very enlightening. But in terms of, like, the content they've given, I feel like it's so impactful, maybe because the cast is that good. But, like, just for Michelle's confessional at the end, yeah, she doesn't just, like, it's not just, like, I'm voting out, or I'm doing this vote based on, like, as an isolated case. It's also like, let me connect it to the history of who I am as a player. And all of these players have that in such a compelling way. So then her confessional is about how she has something to prove in her game as she's making maybe the biggest move of her Survivor career, the biggest strategic move of her Survivor career. So when you get these confessionals that link the game or this particular game to past seasons, Adam's had a few of those, or to where they've come from, the fact that Parvati can have a confessional about what being a mother means, you know, compared to where she was before. But then she also gets these very Micronesia era confessionals where she talks about spitting out Adam's bones. Like, there's so much history in every word. And that's why I'm saying it's all very weighty, which is great. And then beyond that, definitely go check out the secret scenes, because it's all such excellent content.
Yeah, it is actually quite tear-jerking at some points, because even when you, like, I saw Amber on Age of Extinction, there was a flashback in my mind when she'd given Rob her fire token to All Stars when she was cheering him on a challenge, which, I mean, it's like, it's all these people's lives, but it's also, as fans, it's kind of your life, because the last time you would have seen that happen would have been when you were much younger and times are much simpler. To everyone, really, the same nostalgia exists. So that the series is really weighty in terms of, like, not only the series relevance, but also television in general's relevance, because this game changed the nature of television forever. And, you know, on a personal level, it reflects some change in all of our lives, and I think it's really impactful that that's happening. So, yeah, I think this whole experience has been so rich. And I think, you know, you refer to these confessionals, which sort of tie up different elements in different seasons. And it's absolutely the truth. I mean, imagine this. Boston Rob was consulted as an expert for a season of Survivor in season 39. Like, he was the champion. He was the expert. And now we are literally watching him scramble using these tactics he was supposedly an expert on, trying his best to try and stay afloat, which I think is like a great set of poetic examples of how, you know, this game can humble a person. So yeah, it's just all good. And I am so impressed, because I had high expectations and some of them have been surpassed thus far.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that Sandra and Rob have, like, really earned their statues, and that, like, especially Rob isn't currently on Edge of Extinction, even though he has lost everyone. But just, like, I was just smiling to myself. Well, not smiling, I was heartbroken, but just, like, the layers of knowing, like, that Ethan gives his fire token to Parvati and what that relationship is, knowing that Parvati met her husband at a grassroots soccer event. Like, these are the layers that it goes to. And then kind of smirking, knowing that Ethan is going to Edge of Extinction with his ex-girlfriend from like 20 years ago when we were all children. There's just so many layers. It's crazy. And before we get into like analyzing the actual strategy and just keep talking about the season, which is so good, I think that a couple of worries or concerns people had preseason was like, A, these people are winners. Winners are boring. They played well. We're not going to have fun, zany characters. I think that's been disproven, maybe mostly by Tony. But yeah, a lot of these players, they play big. They're super fun. They have fun confessionals. I think it's a fun cast wall-to-wall, and none of those concerns were founded. And then I think, you know, what could have been a concern is, like, this is the opposite of Second Chance. Second Chance had inbuilt narratives for every person, a redemption narrative. These people won. The narratives have closed. They've satisfied those narratives, where I actually feel like every single person has such an interesting historic story, whether it's they're trying to cement their legacy, or they're trying to prove their games, or they're trying to clarify their games, maybe for someone like a Ben, or they're different people since we saw them last time, or, you know, where do they sit in the landscape of the season for someone like Adam, who represents us as a super fan, or how do they connect to each other in their histories? I feel like the arcs are weirdly not at all closed for any of them. So it's actually amazing that every single one of them really does have an inbuilt narrative. And yeah, I mean, it's been refreshing that the whole cast is so stellar, that the editing has been so good. We'll talk about Edge of Extinction, but otherwise I got very, very few complaints. I've said it before, it's like going to Disneyland 42 minutes a week. It's a treat.
Yeah, I can completely agree with that. And also, it's going to have a lot of bearing on the rest of Survivor's history. I mean, I'm certain that Natalie will play again. I think she'll certainly play in season 50 or something like that. And the fact that she was voted out first, after her sister was voted out first, in the season she won, there's lots of... But there's lots of depth to that. And I think the fact that we can refer back to this season in the future, it's a turning point. The same way that Heroes versus Villains throughout is like this incredible example of what Survivor should be like. This, I think, will usurp Heroes versus Villains as the best season of all time. I think it's going to stand out as like the height of Survivordom. But I also don't think it's like too self-righteous, you know, in Cambodia. Second Chances, an amazing season, like so fun to watch. And it was like a great cast to play beautifully. And Jeremy was like the ultimate winner in that example. But at some moments, the show became, the cast became obsessed with their own decision-making, and they added like a whole new layer to what we perceive to be Survivor strategy was like. And I don't know if it was even that accurate. I think that like, yes, it was evolved gameplay, and yes, there were lots of like shifting dynamics, but ultimately the game was still the same. And it became quite tiresome to think that like every episode was going to be this battle for the right tactical move. This season hasn't been self-righteous at all. It's literally been people like trying to get to the next vote. There's been like no long-term planning, no final three talk, no like end game visions from anyone, and no grand ideas of someone being like the supreme god of the show. Everyone has had like balances and power, getting things right, getting things wrong. And it, so far, it's just been like pure mess and pure fun. And beyond the fact that my heart's broken about my poor friend Ethan, I'm glad that it's been the way it has been thus far.
Yeah, I mean, it's so dynamic. Like, I love Second Chance. As a strategy nerd, it like definitely appealed to everything I love about the show. But it was kind of consistent in that everyone's narrative was, what did I do wrong? We've all played once, we've all lost once. How can I correct that?
Yeah.
And even though this, what they did wrong was different, that is still like pretty much a similar objective from every person. Whereas like everyone here has such diverse experiences. People who've played and won one time, never had their torch enough. People who've played four times, people who've been mentors on the island. You know, there's people old school, new school. Like it's such a, besides the fact that they're all winners, it's actually such a diverse group of people, and their objectives are also different. You know, if it's someone like Kim, the objective is prove that it wasn't a fluke, prove that I'm that good. If you're someone like Michelle, you're saying like, you have to prove, I have to prove my game flat out. I'm not cementing anything. I'm actually still having to prove it. Then if you're someone, you know, obviously with more of a legacy, then it might just be finishing on a high note. Or if you're someone who hasn't played for a very long time, it's kind of showing who you are now and how that person can play now. So it's so diverse and dynamic. They aren't really that unified by being, you know, by being winners, which is interesting. They are unified by that. But then beyond that, there's just layers upon layers of what makes these characters really interesting. I think, you know, last time I did the podcast, I definitely got a couple of comments of like, do you think Shannon likes the season? Because I went on for roughly around this much time just hyping it up, which we've done again. It's really hard not to get into that because I'm just so hyped up. I hope people can at least appreciate that. It's just because I'm so excited and I didn't get to talk about it for 2 weeks. So now I'm just like, the latter scene. What a time to be alive. But I do want to talk about the vote itself and stop just like, again, just the eternal scream. And I guess we should start from Jeremy and Michelle's standpoints, because for two people who were left out of the first vote, and since the last time I podcasted, left them in not the greatest of positions, they've obviously come to such a great point and they really did lead this vote. So what did you think about them?
I thought that the relationship between them was really interesting because without it ever being shown to us, these two obviously have confided in each other and are going to be working together. And it wasn't really an obvious thought, but now it makes so much sense because they are quite similar in the way they play. They both are very understated. They both are obviously very charming people and they can get people to do what they want through persuasion. So I think that this
relationship makes absolute sense. I'm pretty sure they're friends in real life, to be fair as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think that they're like the Northeastern Alliance, but like, shouldn't Boston Rob be in that, being literally like from Boston? I feel like I'm getting my American geography right. I feel like the Boston style alliance coming after Boston Rob's alliance is like sacrilegious.
Yeah, but I think these, I mean, and what was great about the move was that it isolated Adam, which puts him below them, and it weakened the old school alliance. And most importantly, I don't think anyone's going to be like too angry about it. Obviously, it makes sense. Boston, Robin, and Poverty are going to be hurt by it. But I don't think that they're going to be like, you know, target number one and two in the tribe. I still think that Adam will be this person who is going to be targeted most by the old school alliance, what's left of it, the two people who remain. And then you still have Poverty and Boston, Robin, the game, who are the biggest threats around in the Sele tribe. So I think that the move just was well executed, and very rarely do you see a move being played out this early that will probably have no negative effect on their game, because oftentimes people will take shots early on in the game and then that's used as a justification to remove them later on. I don't think neither Michelle nor do I think Jeremy is going to like suffer from the move. I don't think anyone's going to be like, okay, these two are now gonna be voted out before merge, or even in the first three votes after merge, because they took out Ethan. I think that it's a logical move, and I don't think it's like caused that much disdain in the group. I don't think the effect of it will be that dire for them.
Yeah, I agree. And just to clarify, Michelle, I know, is from New Jersey, but I am pretty sure she moved to Boston, and that's where she and Jeremy connected. So I actually do think the Boston connection was the undoing of Boston Rob's alliance. It kind of is amazing if you think about it. But yeah, from Michelle, like, as someone who, you know, thought Aubrey should have won, I'll come out and say that what Michelle has always had is the social game. We've always known that. I just don't think in Korong I really saw her wield it strategically. I know she was well liked. I know she was liked enough to get juror votes. I know she was liked enough to be in alliances, but I didn't see her actively using that as a strategic weapon. And this episode, I saw that tenfold. You know, we saw her going around and having those social conversations, and it was all had that social basis, but it was to make, I think, a bigger move than Michelle's ever made in her career. And but I also, importantly, you know, as much as she talks about needing to prove herself, I actually also really don't think it was a big move for big move's sake, because as you said, I think they're well insulated. And yeah, I get it. Like, I get not wanting to trust Adam with the new plans and leaving him out, so you have to vote with that 4 out of 8 plurality. But I also get that you don't really want Adam to be the target right now, because he's, you know, he's not as big a threat as these three very tight, very powerful old schoolers. I get not going for Poverty. The plan has outed her. At that point, you got to blindside Boston Rob and his alliance. You're not going after the obvious target, surely. And I've heard that Michelle had wanted to work with Poverty. Jeremy thought he could work with Boston Rob. Boston Rob obviously offers quite a bit in challenges as a shield with his individual relationships. We'll talk about the amazing things he's doing. But, like, I get Ethan as a surprising target. He's always threatening in his own right. He's maybe not as helpful in the challenges. He's more threatening than Adam. And I totally get that. So while it was a big move and a very good move, I don't think it was just for the sake of being like, you said I couldn't make moves in Korong. Well, here I am. And, yeah, I honestly think, like, some of the best gameplay I've ever seen from Michelle, and she already won a season.
Yeah, and that's actually a really important beat, because perhaps Michelle wasn't the strategic mastermind she claimed she was on Karong, and that's fine. You know, sometimes people win seasons by sort of just like being a likable person and having great social skills, and that's totally okay. That's the nature of Survivor. It encourages that sort of behavior. But she's now been put in a season with the best players of all time, and she's made a really consequential and a really remarkable move. So even if you don't feel like she was the ultimate player in Karong, I think that the fact that she's done this well in Winners at War adds an incredible amount of validity to her name. And she has proven that she is a strong strategist already. And so for Michelle, it's just a general win, because if she makes it to the end now, she's got this as a point of excellence in her resume. Like, she can be like, okay, well, I found redemption here. And it takes the heat off of her, because I know from like my experience of being on Survivor, I remember very clearly thinking to myself, I need to make sure I've got something to prove that I played a good game throughout the whole time. And that's why I was always like quite eager to like push the envelope a bit. Michelle's done that now, and the vote has been really powerful, and she can sort of sit back for a while and lay low and take it easy if she chooses to do that, because she's got a strong pre-merge move that she pulled the trigger on that put her firmly in a driving seat in the game. And I think obviously Jeremy is benefiting as much from it. I don't think that Jeremy is questioned as often as Michelle is. So while Jeremy is like this recognized fantastic player, he's done really well now. Michelle has oftentimes been lambasted by the community for being perhaps a weaker player than Aubrey at Kaorong. So I think she deserves credit here. You know, she's really flexed her muscles and has shown that she is a strategic force. And honestly, like, she looked completely at ease doing it. She was not for a second flustered. She was methodical. She was mechanical. She was really, really clinical in the way she went about executing this plan. So she blew me away. I was so surprised by how good she was.
Completely agree. Like, she had complete clarity of what needed to be done in terms of the plan. She had the relationships, which we know she's always had, to make it happen. And while, like, it's totally valid to win by having a great social game and that being most of what you've impressed the jury with or why people are voting for you, completely valid, but something I think would be really, really difficult to achieve on Winners at War. So she kind of knew she had to step it up and use her social game more actively or more purposely or more lethally, as she's done here. I honestly think as well for Michelle, with what she's been trying to achieve, she'd rather not win than win again as like the ineffectual social player. I really do believe that. Absolutely. She wanted to come out and show that, like, yes, she has social chops, but she can use them and do more than that. And she's already shown that. So I hope it doesn't become a thing where it's like, I'm going to keep making big moves. Like, I hope they continue to be well-timed, well thought out, really clear, really well executed. And then, you know, have a kind of build on her reputation that way. Because I think that from a lot of the stuff she was saying pre-season, I honestly think Michelle would be happy to just like tear through this season strategically, show the chops she's had and that she's gained and that she's grown, and even not win. Because I think that's what she's trying to get out of it, is to just prove. $2 million is nice. Everyone wants to win. But I think if she can come out here and kind of have changed her reputation to be not just social, but socially strategic and really dangerous, that's what she wants to get out of it. And that's, she's done great in terms of that as well.
And that is a motivation for many people playing Survivor. Like, to have a good time is definitely a motivation behind it. That was my intention of going to play Survivor. Was I was like, I don't really care about winning that much. I said in my submission video when I entered that I wasn't concerned about winning the game. And it was more just like a personal experience. And I think Michelle could be doing that. You know, she's got $1 million in the bank. She's clearly someone who's smart and can probably find a way to be successful in any scenario, whether she had won Survivor or not. So I think that it's really there to test not only herself, but also to prove herself to the community. Because no matter what anyone says, like, yo, you can be really insulated and you can try your best to make sure that you are confident in yourself enough to ignore the comments. They are scathing and they're horrific. And people are really, really mean to you. And if you are playing Survivor, you can't help but like head onto the Reddit and have a look. And people are just like absurdly
really
mean.
To be fair, Reddit may be her platform, but the other platforms, yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah. But so just generally speaking, though, I mean, people are quite critical of this sort of thing. So the fact that she's been able to do this now is fantastic for her. I'm glad that she's had the opportunity to do it. And I hope that it leads to like a momentum build for her, because she's been the real, I mean, her and Ben certainly have been the two most surprising players for me this season. I think that they are both so fun. I was like kind of uncertain about them in the context of Winners at War, but they've both added such layer, like such texture to the season. And I'm happy with both of them being there now.
I would agree. Like, Sarah Lucina as well would be one for me, but like, she's so fun with Tony.
Yeah, absolutely.
So like, there's just like, there's no weak spots. It's actually crazy like that. You know, the question, like the eternal question is always, would you rather win, be a bad winner, or like a legend Rob Goddess? And like, I think asking that to Michelle pre-Winners at War, having already won Kaorong, is like I would be fascinated to know if she would rather be like,
yeah.
I mean, how would you be a bad winner in Winners at War, but like seen as an ineffectual winner, or to just like destroy this game and come like agonizingly short? Like, based on everything she said preseason, like, I would have to think, I don't know, $2 million is a lot. Maybe I'm overstating it, but I genuinely think she obviously did come out here with a plan of wanting to change people's minds, and she's doing great with that. Whereas like Jeremy, who she's working with, has a very different agenda. He has not a lot to prove, nothing to prove. And if anything, he's like way out in front always. He's Jeremy. He looks like he does. He plays in challenges like he does. His relationship with Nat was already so threatening that they got rid of her. So for him to let Michelle kind of take the lead on a vote he's still controlling is perfect for him as well. So I think that that was like such a symbiotic relationship, and the way this move happened couldn't have happened better for the way that she kind of took charge. He stepped back. They both got their way. And now they're like in the best spot in the trial after having been left out of the Nat vote.
Onto Jeremy for a moment. I think that we also need to appreciate that Jeremy is firmly cementing himself as one of the greatest of all time in my mind, because obviously his situation in Second Chances was remarkable and is noted as that. But sometimes we're reluctant to put him in the same category as some of the best players of all time because he wasn't as strong in San Juan del Sur. And I think that you need to isolate that season, because obviously the first situation was dealing with the fact that his wife was in the game with him, and he was part of the reason that she then left because he beat her in the couple challenge or whatever it was called. I forget the name. But the fact that he had his wife there was quite a... He was almost hamstrung by it in some way. And that's not to say that she wouldn't be a great survivor player on her own. It's just that playing together, it's difficult, I'm sure. So I think with Second Chances, he really showed that he is a fantastic strategist and a really strong social player. And yeah, he's been so intriguing to watch because... Clearly, in the beginning, he was put into the back foot. He survived that vote. And from that, he's just been purely inquisitive. Like, we haven't heard him speaking as much. He's been very, like, cautious about the way he's conducted himself around camp. But also, he's self-assured. You know, he was the first person to get up once the stir-off happened, because he was like, this is nonsense. I'm not going to allow myself to be bogged down by these ridiculous tactics. And he kept it real. So I think that Jeremy is he's like a natural survivor player. And I'm sure we'll get back to him later on, because I saw some questions about Rob Bentele from Survivor South Africa and Boston Rob. And for me, when I watch Jeremy, I am reminded very much of the way Rob Bentele plays and lives life. But I'm sure we'll get back to that later on.
Well, no, I do want to talk about that, because we did get a lot of questions about Rob v. Rob. And that was a comparison we made when we were doing the Island of Secrets coverage so many times, because their names are both Rob and they're both two of the best players ever. Yeah. So it's very, very easy to kind of make that comparison. I mean, I do think Boston Rob is the godfather in ways that I don't think Rob Bentele is. Like, I think Rob Bentele has a deft touch. So that's interesting that you see Jeremy. Like, what are the common things that you see from him to your survivor, Rob?
Well, pretty much the way that they laugh is identical. That's the first thing. I think that
Rob
Bentele's
laugh is outrageous. We love it. Like, in the deep dive, he's so softly spoken, and then he has like this outrageous laugh, and I'm genuinely obsessed with it.
But Jeremy and him laugh the same way. But beyond that, obviously Boston Rob and Rob Bentele are these two players who have incredible social skills. You know, they can make you feel like you're on top of the world if they pay you a second's worth of attention. And I think that's why Rob is still there. People underappreciate how influential Rob being nice to people actually is. The fact that he was like playing with the leaf on Adam's nose is the editor's trying to convey to us that Rob is someone who is just really, really strong socially.
I would think the I would murder someone if they woke me up by touching my nose. Let me sleep.
If it was Boston Rob, you would say thank you for waking me up on time. I was worried I was going to sleep.
That's tragic.
He's just that good. Like, his social skills are incredible, and people crave his attention. And that was shown early in Rob's career. Was like he avoided a lot of trouble in Marquesas because he was such a nice guy, such a likable person, such a dominant figure. And it's happened over and over and over again. And the only time he fell short was certainly it was Heroes versus Villains. But he came back and he showed it again in Redemption Island. And he showed it here. Like, yes, Rob, I'm almost certain won't win the game. In fact, I'll be stunned if he makes it to Merge. I'll eat my hat, because I think he's under too much pressure right now. I'll fly to Boston and I'll steal the hats and I'll eat it from him, because it'll be that good if he makes it to Merge. He's under intense pressure right now. He's in an almost untenable scenario, and unless there's a tribe swap coming up immediately, I don't see Rob making it much further, because there's just no way for him to go. He's like swimming in a glass cage, really. So I don't think that him being voted out will be a stain on his career. I think he's already proved himself this game, that he is as good as he reckons himself to be and that the community thinks he is. He's fantastic. He might have like blown a couple of puzzles, but he showed in episode one that he's still got the gift of a good challenge performance. And
he was pretty good in this puzzle. Like, he caught up type. If anything, he was much worse on like the toss.
Yeah.
But, you know, whatever. Yeah, yeah. I don't care about this stuff. He's still great.
Yeah, also, I mean, just the fact that he's putting himself in the firing line, it's much easier to just blend in, but he's doing it. And I think it just lends itself to the argument that Rob is an all-time great. So Rob is all these things. He's like heroic, he's iconic, he's loud, he's abrasive. The way he deals with people is impressive because he asks you things directly and he doesn't mince his words about it. Rob Bentley is far more subtle than Boston Rob. And they are similar in the way they're presented on screen, but they are not similar in character, I don't believe. Rob Bentley is far more... willing to be reserved about the way he approaches things. If you are going to cross Rob, he won't confront you directly. I don't think he'll instead find a way to take you out of the equation stealthily. And I think that's far more like Jeremy's game plan. Jeremy is able to assess someone's value to him at arm's length. So he can be like, okay, this person offers this much value to me. This is why I want them here and there. And then he can weigh up his options and then stealthily find a way to take you out of the equation. Whether he becomes the person who pulls the trigger or not, it's going to happen. It's inevitable. So I think that the similarity between Boston Rob and, I mean, Rob Bentley and Jeremy is insane. They both are very strong characters, very soft-spoken, but ultimately are very endearing. The interesting thing is sometimes you see the pictures online of like Camp Life, and on almost everyone, Jeremy's like having a giggle with someone, he's laughing. He seems to be like a really nice person, and he just endears himself to people through being sincere, and that's just like Rob Bentley. So I see a far stronger comparison in the way these guys are soft-spoken, but also really calculated, really stealthy about the way they do things, then I see a comparison between Boston Rob and Rob Bentley.
Yeah, I can totally see that. Because I think like, okay, well, how did Boston Rob win in Redemption Island? It's like he had his Rob zombies, and it was a lot of like the culture of fear and this like cult-like thing. And I don't feel that that's really how, like besides saying like no one can talk to Jacques, I don't feel like that's really how Rob Bentley operated. I think it was much more like Jeremy. It's like they're both big threats. Why are people not taking them out? Not really due to fear, but more due to like, I have my own personal relationship with him. He's my number one. Everyone felt that, you know, Jeremy and that Rob Bentley were their number ones. And it was more of a social thing, I think, than like a fear intimidation thing. So I can totally see that. I think it is like a softer touch. And I think that goes missing from Jeremy. I mean, Jeremy is someone who they took out in San Juan del Sur because he was that threatening, because he would definitely win at the end, because he definitely win challenges, a lot like Rob Bentley. But when he came back, he just endeared himself to so many people and connected with so many different people. Another thing that Rob Bentley does, where it's like he can connect with like the bros and he can connect with like every different type of personality, and then everyone thinks that he's like a major part of their plan, so they can't get rid of him. So I definitely see those connections. And I think Jeremy has, again, proven on that legacy here, because to lose Nat was kind of unavoidable, probably. Like, that's the tightest connection in the tribe. But how the way that he has bounced back from that and not had his name mentioned, and not even that, the fact that he and Michelle are in the middle of things shows how many connections he must have. I think the one he has to Boston Rob is probably underrated. I mean, poker connection, they probably hear you screaming about it from the other beach. We've heard kind of, like, from other sources that Boston Rob and Jeremy, like, that might be something that's keeping Boston Rob around. And I wonder if there's like a connection in the fact that Natalie, Jeremy's person, went first and then Amber went, because I don't think it's a coincidence that Nat and Jeremy had that connection when Nadia and Val went, that Tyson and Jervis had that connection when Marissa and Rachel went, and those were the first two people who went. So I wonder if there is a little bit of that camaraderie. Even though Boston Rob did vote out Natalie and was a part of that, they both have kind of like lost the partner they thought they would have. And I wonder if that does endear them to each other, even though this isn't a blood versus water season.
I think that's a brilliant point you've made. And I think there is the blood versus water creeping in, because ultimately the way that we saw Jeremy and Natalie conduct relationships in San Juan also lends itself to the notion that these two people are very close and almost are like family in Survivor's context. Because when Jeremy was sort of topped at the knees when Natalie went, I would imagine that he would have been in a tough place mentally. And it's something that's often underrated by people who simply analyze strategy. Survivor's really brutal as a game. Like, it's a tough experience to do. And I don't care like who you are and what you can tell me. I mean, even if you've been out there like 5 or 6 times like Rob has, I'm pretty sure that going back out there is always going to be grueling, and it's always going to be tough on you, and it's always going to feel overwhelming because it's day 3 and you've lost an ally and you've got to survive another 36 days in this game to win. It's a long, long time to realize you're going to be hungry, you're going to be cold, you're going to be in the rain. It's just, it's brutal. It's a tough, tough thing to get right. So when Jeremy would have had that happen to him in episode 1, where he lost the really close ally, the fact that he's been able to like hone himself in and pull himself together and find a way forward is really, really impressive. You know, credit must be given to him for that, because it's not easy. It's overwhelming sometimes. You can honestly feel like, oh man, I've got no way around this. What can I do? How can I get out of here? And that would have been the feeling on day three for him. So, and now it's day nine and he's picking up momentum. So I think he's just in a really, really good spot. And I think as much as Michelle's legacy has been enhanced by this, Jeremy's has been confirmed and probably is going to be, you know, he's going to stand out for me after the season as one of the best of all time, even if he gets voted out before merge. I think he's proven that to me, certainly.
Yeah, I agree. Especially when you're someone like Jeremy, it's like they probably will come for him at a point. Like, I honestly, I feel I'm so kind to these players' legacies. Like, I have so much reverence for so many of them. Unless you do something like really terrible, I'm probably going to say, like, there's not a lot you could have done. Like, certainly, like, Ethan going out fourth is meaningless to me. I haven't, like, lost any respect for him. Danny, I'm not so sure about Danny, for example. Amber was pretty much exactly who I thought she would be, in the fact that, like, she won in Season 8, and it feels like she's still playing in Season 8. Like, that makes sense to me. I don't know if it puts her down in my estimations. It just kind of, like, confirms what I thought about her.
Danny was a real surprise to me, I'm going to be honest with you. I thought that she would have been a little... Although, we are fed a limited edit, so...
I mean, it wasn't great. I
saw on social media.
We saw what we saw, like... What we saw was not good, and that stuff at least definitely happened.
Yes. Yeah. Well, she said that we didn't quite see the full extent of it, so we're not quite sure where the paranoia all came from, because it seemed like it was completely ridiculous that she was being as paranoid as she was. But I think that certainly, you know, the legacy of Dani, as she didn't do herself any favors in Guatemala by not giving us, like, an explanation about her game during the game. It was quite a weird edit to see her win. So I don't think that her legacy has been improved upon in winners at award. Well, I think, in fact, it's probably been, like, detracted from. But that also is the nature of the game, and that's totally okay. I'm sure she's a great player, and I'm sure that we'll see her pulling some strings on Edge of Extinction. But certainly, I don't think that if Jeremy was to go next, you know, I don't think his legacy would be blighted by that at all. I think he's really confirmed it to me, and Michelle has just, like, stepped it up a notch. Although, in saying that, Michelle, I mean, I was almost certain she would get very close to the end, because she wasn't really seen as a threat. Perhaps this is the move that makes things rush for her a little bit. Maybe she gains some confidence. Maybe she then pulls the trigger on one or two more moves, and maybe she might become a serious threat into the merge. We don't know. This could be the catalyst for Michelle's threat level.
Look, if Michelle pulls a couple of other great moves, becomes too threatening and is taken out, it will still improve on her legacy for me, because kind of like floating to the end without doing anything, like, I already know she can play that game, so, like, I don't need to see it twice. Yeah. Whereas, like, if she even goes earlier than she would have, but I don't know, to be honest, like, I know she has a great social game. I didn't know if Michelle had the strategic chops to do something like that. And now, like, what she did in this episode. And now I know that she could. So yeah, it does improve on that. Even if she gets swapped through next, we don't see much more of her. I'm like, well, I didn't know there were other tricks in your bag, in your strategic bag. And now I know that there are. So for me, it's definitely an improvement. But Danny, she was like one of the winners we knew the least about. So I think she had the most to lose and gain from a legacy standpoint, because we had quite a bit to learn from her, whereas we know much more about most of the other winners. For her, it wasn't even the paranoia. It was the fact that she would like have the terrible read to go to Boston Rob, which people keep doing, and throw out Parvati's name. Like, those were the problems I was having. But like, in terms of that, to kind of look at it from the old schoolers' perspective, Ethan went home, old schoolers lost out. Where did it go wrong? Was voting out Danny the wrong move? Was voting out Nat the wrong move? Was this inevitable? Like, there must be what is the reason, basically, that they lost at this vote?
Yeah, it's such an interesting thing, because I was of the opinion that the old school versus new school thing wouldn't be that consequential. I didn't think that if you had time away from the game, you would struggle that much to adapt. I thought maybe for 2 or 3 days, you might be able to like find your feet and make sense of things. But I don't believe that like the strategy of Survivor is out of in the next dimension from where it was initially. The game is still the same. Yes, there are elements of twist included. And yes, sometimes the moves people pull are miraculous and unlike anything we'd have seen in the early days. But I think if you watch Survivor, like, you should have a good idea about how to make sense of many of these things. So I was hoping that the old school versus new school gulf wouldn't be that severe. Unfortunately, that theory has been disproven thoroughly by the fact that on Edge of Extinction right now sits 3 old schoolers and 1 new schooler. And
it's a bit upsetting to me,
because honestly,
they're sitting there like for diverse reasons. It's not like a full old school onslaught.
Yeah, but mostly, I mean, it's hard to make the argument that the difference between an old school player and a new school player doesn't exist when that is what's happened in the first 4 episodes.
That's true.
So I don't think that, you know, I don't think that it's been easy for the old schoolers to make sense of things thus far. And I think that the reason things have gone wrong, first of all, is it's numerical. You know, the fact that you had some players who were very clearly older than the rest, or very clearly in a different, from a different era than the rest, made it hard for them to negotiate that initially. I mean, you think Boston Rob, you think Ethan, and you think Poverty, and those players are from a certain generation. They almost put in the same brackets. Whereas Natalie and Rob played very few seasons apart. I think Redemption Island was like 24, hey? Was
22.
It 23 or 24?
22.
22. And then San Juan Loso was 28.
29.
So it's not like Boston Rob... 29, okay, yeah. My name was a bit wrong. But it's not like there was a huge gulf between when Boston Rob played. Yeah. It's not like there was a huge gulf between when Boston Rob played last and when
Boston Rob was on Island of the Idols. Like, he's the most new school player that we have. Yeah,
the last time he could have won was not too long after.
Boston Rob didn't have time to go home before the last time he was in Fiji on that beach. Like, he's the most. Like, yes, he's not playing, but he's like. He's there. He's like watching it all happen. He's at tribal council. The man is as new school as it gets.
Yeah, he's seen all the moves. He's helped orchestrate them. He's been an integral part of new school survivor strategy. But the point is, I think that like it's been hyped up by the players on the island, and it makes sense. Of course, the distinctions are logical, and you can clearly see that Nat is a new school player versus Pav is an old school player. But in reality, the differences weren't that stark. And I just think that numerically, like, it was no real way to negotiate it. I don't blame Boston Rob and Poverty and Ethan for creating an old school alliance. It's logical. It makes sense. First of all, these people have relationships beyond the game, which I suppose are important in a return season. But also just logically, I don't think that anyone would have been too keen to endear themselves to Rob from the new school alliance in the first vote. I don't think that anyone would have been like, okay, he has, let's form a relationship with Rob because he is the number one target. So, yeah, I think the fact that these guys are these like classic legendary figures was the downfall initially. I don't think they stood much of a chance, in all honesty. I don't think anyone went into the season thinking, you know, Boston Rob has a serious chance of winning Winners at War. I think that perhaps Poverty had a good shot because she proved herself in very difficult circumstances in superseding seasons, certainly in Micronesia and in Heroes versus Villains. She showed that she was like this incredibly adept person at avoiding scrutiny. But I don't think that like it was anyone's fault per se. I think Danny, you know, was a weak link in the situation. I think that had she been a bit stronger, it would have made a bit of a balance of power. But in this scenario, you had three players up against a tribe of, you know, nine after the first vote. And I don't think there was much of a chance that they were going to survive it.
I agree that the numbers were the problem. Here's the issue that I find with it is if I've learned anything from doing deep dives and exit interviews, it's that we see like 1/100th of the alliances that are out there, right? We've seen the new school thing. We've seen the old school thing. But, you know, you can even tell that, you know, as we've said, there's Boston Rob maybe working with Jeremy. There's Michelle working with Poverty. Clearly, Adam thinks he has his relationships. Denise wanted to give the idol to Poverty. That can't be out of nowhere. There are relationships we don't see. So, well, I mean, honestly, there must be relationships we don't understand. So how did the narrative of the tribe, how did the driving narrative become old school versus new school? That's my issue for the old schoolers, because it could have been really anything. Like, it always, you know, I always think that the way these tribes separate is if it's in two things, it's always some iteration of beach versus shelter people. I honestly think that's like the most eternal, perfect encapsulation of two types of mentalities that emerge on a tribe. But for some reason, the driving narrative became old school versus new school, which wasn't good for the old schoolers, because even with Danny, there was only four of them in what was a tribe of nine once these groups kind of broke down. So that wasn't going to work out. You know, in a different world, it could be gender. It could be personality types. It could be geography. Like, there's anything that can separate people. But for some reason in this tribe, as opposed to the other tribe, this isn't happening. I mean, there's one-time players versus multi-connections kind of happening. So that's like a different iteration of it. But old versus new was in big, bold writing all over this tribe. And that became the driving narrative. And unfortunately, like, 4 into 9 is out. So it wasn't going to work anyway. Like, I don't begrudge any of them for taking out Danny. At that point, I think Danny has made herself the problem. She's coming for Poverty. She doesn't give you a majority anyway. She's probably worse for you than the new schoolers, because she's the one outright yelling Poverty's name the loudest. And it's either her or Poverty. So of course they all threw her under the bus. Like, I know that there was conversation during the week of like, well, the old schoolers must think that they have a majority, because why else would they throw Danny under the bus? I'm not so sure. I think they kind of knew it was a bad spot, but at the end of the day, she doesn't give them a majority anyway, and she was terrible for them, so they probably thought they had to just, like, deal with that, save Parvati for a round, just throw her under the bus, recoup, and then just kind of get back to a point where they could kind of try to pull in more numbers. But they couldn't. And, like, to be fair, that three is not just a minority, they're three epic players. You know, in another world, Boston Rob and Parvati don't align. It's kind of crazy that they have. And then maybe it's Boston Rob's people versus Parvati's people, and that's how the tribe is divided. But when they came together, it was just such a power source that you can kind of understand how all of the other players at a point started consolidating against them. And that made a majority, and that's what manifested itself as old versus new. And that was very problematic for a minority of old schoolers.
You probably would find that if you were to ask Boston Rob or Parvati about it, it would be less distinct in reality. You probably
would find that.
Yeah. So while we see this relationship making sense, and for us, it certainly is clear that they are very well aligned, and Ethan was included in that alignment. It probably is less clear for the players on the island, and it's probably just the point of division, because in Survivor, you know, you work with what you can. So you see, here is an opportunity. Can we find a crack here? And you exploit that crack. And in this situation, I'm pretty certain that we had a situation, like we saw the way that things were panning out. Adam was someone who needed to find traction, because on day one, he went looking for idols, perhaps with Denise. We didn't actually get too much clarity on that, but they were certainly on the outs. And Adam would have maybe perpetuated that narrative to some of the new schoolers. And then the old schoolers used the term old school versus new school. And then Danny mentions it too. And then it confirms it in someone else's mind. So this whole situation of old school versus new school was probably just like one narrative stream in a thousand.
Yeah, just one version of the alliances. Maybe a super close version of the alliances, but it's not as binary, I think, as the show projects. It never is.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see now how Boston Rob and Poverty move on from this, because they would have been disappointed about Ethan's removal, but is it crucial for them? Is it critical? Is it a disaster? This is the big question here. I think, you know, Ethan spoke about this vote being the one that draws the line in the sand, and it certainly has been, because we now see that the old school versus new school situation is true. But does Boston Rob secretly have a strong relationship with Jeremy, as you've alluded to? Does Poverty have a strong relationship with Denise? Perhaps does Denise flip on her alleged Malcolm of the season? I think Adam probably is more of a Russell Swan than he is a Malcolm of the season, because Denise is a smart player and she can probably tell that Adam is on the back foot here. So does she perhaps then endear herself to Poverty? Michelle, I read online, said she wanted to work with Poverty. So is this as distinct as we think it is? Is this the justification behind it? Or was that a narrative tool for us to make sense of the last two vote outs? And can Boston Rob and Poverty find a way to create a new set of relationships in this tribe, which go beyond the narrative of old school versus new school? Because as we know, in modern Survivor, people are very eager to try and break alliances. It's almost like something that gives you a sense of credibility. We can refer back to a recent example, Alec in David vs. Goliath. He didn't need to break the Goliath dominance. He could have like had an easy spot in the final seven or final eight by just sticking to the alliance. But because the nature of Survivor's changed so much, it was a logical thing for him to do. And it was great that he did it, because it opened up the game and created a great season. So I don't think that the old school versus new school thing is going to have as much of a bearing as has been alluded to this far. Although in saying that, I don't see Boston Rob getting much further simply because he's Boston Rob.
I mean, I don't think that the old school, new school thing is just a TV narrative. Like, I do think it is the dominating narrative of the tribe, at least now after this vote. I just think that there are so many alliances we don't see. But the reason that, like, the edit captures that one narrative is because that's the one that ends up having the most relevance. You know, there might be so many alliances that never play out or hardly play out, whereas, like, definitely old school versus new school ended up being strategically relevant. Like, they just voted along those lines. So that's what the edit captures. I'm just saying, like, if the old school people did anything wrong, it was allowing that to be the major way that the tribe was divided. Even though there's probably so many interconnections and individual relationships, like, there's going to be a driving, like, strategic vote, and that's going to be this driving narrative on the beach, and then that's going to be the driving edit, and somehow they allowed that to be old versus new when old was not the numbers that they needed. So I think, like, that is, if anything, like, a problem. Like, I look back and wonder, if they vote out Adam instead of Nat, is Jeremy even more in lockstep with Rob? Are they then creating a culture of more, like, picking off the bottom feeders rather than, like, a more fractured threat-taking culture? At that point, have you taken out, like, an Adam, a Denise, or a Ben, a Winners at War, able to go down the line in such, like, almost boring fashion? I don't know. I do think at a point, like, we are just taking for granted that Boston Rob and Pavi are each other's number one allies. Like, I genuinely think, like, does Adam come to Boston Rob and say that he wants to take out Pavi? Because having been a fan of the show, it's almost, like, inconceivable to think that Pavi really, truly does seem to be Boston Rob's number one ally. He tells her about the fire token before he's even gone and seen that Amber's the one who's been voted out. So, like, at that point, everyone wants to know he has a fire token. But, like, before that, he even tells Pavi. So it's kind of inconceivable. I know they said that they could run the game, the two of them, but I think they're also, like, they fuse their targets and, like, this huge giant target. In a different world where at least they're in separate spots and not working together, maybe you're confused, which target should I look at, which group should we go for? But when they put it together, they made it pretty big and flashing that, like, go for the group that has Rob and Pavi working together. That's really, really scary.
In saying that, though, it must be commended that these two are still in the game, despite the fact they've been to how many tribal councils are now?
Three tribal councils they've been to. I'm impressed.
Yeah, so they made that target a thing, and they somehow have avoided being voted out up until this point, and there's still vested interests in their narrative from other players in the game. Poverty wants to be supported by Michelle, and Rob wants to be supported by Jeremy. So they still have a role to play in this tribe. And also maybe they're just great for morale, you know? Maybe there's just Boston Rob is a great provider. We've seen that before. You can make a mean fire. Certainly we saw that in episode one of Island of the Idols. So perhaps that's a factor to consider. You know, your camp life is enjoyable. You've got to make sure your camp life is healthy because you're spending so much time with each other. Perhaps Boston Rob is a great ally to have in camp life, and maybe that's a reason to consider people wanting to work with him. Perhaps Poverty is just like an incredibly endearing person. We don't get all these important beats that the players in the island get. So yes, it's kind of surprising that such a predictable binary was the emergent theme of the first few episodes, old school versus new school. I think there could have been a whole lot of variation with that, but I don't know how much more bearing it's going to have on the game. I think that if Poverty or Rob are taken out before merge, or even while this current iteration still exists, it won't be an old school versus new school thing. It will simply be the fact that these two are, you know, between the two of them, have over 220 days of playing Survivor together. It's more the fact that they are, like, really, really, really strong players than an old school versus new school thing. I think the narrative made sense for Danny's vote, kind of, made sense for Ethan's votes, kind of. But from here on out, I think that idea of old school versus new school, certainly in Cele, is broken.
Well, the oldest of schools is gone. I mean, Rob literally was on the island last season. Poverty played in season 20. At this point, they're just Boston, Rob, and Poverty. You could probably give that other names, like the King and the Queen at this point, instead of old school. But I really
Yeah, give us something new.
Yeah, what is it? That's just a royalty alliance. It's literally just Boston, Rob, and Poverty. It's crazy. That's regal. But I'm so impressed with Boston Rob. Like, saw pretty much 30 variations of the same tweet, which is, if you want to weaken Rob, why not just take out Rob? And this isn't something that happened by accident. Like, this is definitely something the players considered. I did love that, you know, after a lot of episodes of how do we weaken Rob, take out Amber, thought about Poverty, you know, Ethan definitely went to weaken Rob. But when they were talking about Poverty as a target this episode, they were talking about her as giving her due as the legend that is Poverty. That was a Poverty thing, not a Rob thing. But the fact that after the Poverty plan is blown up, you as good Survivor players should be going for a blindside. You can't do Poverty anymore. They don't go to Boston Rob. They go to Ethan. It's like, I can't believe Boston Rob is third in that alliance in the hierarchy of who they will target. It must speak to him as a player. There must be so many things. Are you scared of him? Are you scared he's going to come back from Edge of Extinction anyway? So what's the point? Do you need him in challenges or feel that you need him? Do you need him as a shield if you're someone like a Jeremy? Do you just have that many good individual relationships with him where, aside from Ben, who doesn't like him, do you not want to lose that connection? Whatever it is that he's doing, and I'm sure it's probably all of those things and other things I haven't even considered, that is a credit to him, that he could be the third option. And not only that, that two episodes in a row, Danny and Adam came to him and told him that they want to vote out Poverty, his number one ally, must speak to how well he's covering some bases or how he's allowing people to misread him. Like, he talks about Adam. Adam misread him as a character. He misread his relationship with Boston Rob. So that's on Boston Rob. That's like the cloak of mystery that he's putting on to just manipulate people. And it's not just like, oh, damn, we just didn't think about voting out Boston Rob. If only we'd had that thought.
Yeah.
They've considered it. And Boston Rob has somehow worked against that and saved himself. And it's that impressive. It really is.
Well, here's something to think about in this situation. Obviously, like, at home, we scream at the TV, why not vote out Boston Rob? It's the obvious choice. He's the man of the moment, and we should all Yeah, exactly. But remember that we've seen one more season of Survivor with him, with his face on the island in a statue form. So these players know that was a thing. They understand that Island of the Idols happened. But they also, the last time people on the island saw Boston Rob play was in Redemption Island, which is a long time ago. Like, it's a very, very different time of Survivor. So Rob, perhaps the allure around him, you can contextualize, you can say, okay, so we are winners at war, and Rob and Poverty are two targets who are not going to win the game. It's almost certain that they won't get to the end. At some point, they're going to be picked off. So are they at the top of our priority list?
But Ethan
Whereas
could win.
Ethan.
Yeah.
But my point is, Ethan, the last time Ethan played was in All-Stars, and even there he was picked off really early. So the last time we saw Ethan with a really domineering game was in Africa, which is so long ago that the legacy almost doesn't exist. He's just like this person who's like a really nice guy and is really enjoyable and is actually like quite competent around camp. He seems to be this really endearing person. So suddenly perhaps you then think to yourself, well, if Boston Rob and Poverty are so good that they're guaranteed to be voted at some point in the game, is perhaps Ethan the best option right now, because he might find a way to get deeper and he won't be with us because he was against us in early Sele. So that's something to consider. The fact that perhaps Rob and Poverty had such big targets going into the game that it's almost inevitable that they will lose. And a person like Ethan, who perhaps, you know, could go all the way to the end, I certainly could see Ethan getting really, really deep, was a more pressing target because his old games had no real bearing on the situation that was at Winners at War. And he was basically playing fresh. He was almost like a player who had won and was coming back as a brand new player in some way. He had a heightened threat level when compared with the other two because he wasn't an automatic vote out after merge or whatever.
Well, I actually think that Island of the Idols like took away from Boston Rob's threat level having watched it, because he became like this like cartoon character, and like Boston Rob is like the pop figure rather than like the player. And then when he plays, you're like, oh yeah, you remember that he's that good. So I actually think if they'd seen Island of the Idols, they might have like been a little bit, you know, it's not like he gave out any like particularly fantastic advice where they were like, this guy's got to go. Like, yeah, he was kind of a, like, it was a bit of a joke. So I actually think it would have been better for him and Sandra's reputation. Although I do think that if she'd seen it, Nat would definitely have been giving the advantage to Sandra, knowing that Sandra can hide behind trees and everything. Like, I definitely think that she would have been giving that to her. But yeah, for Boston Rob, this is how he wins. Like, It's not inevitable that he's going to get voted out. He is one tribe swap away from connecting with Tyson, from connecting with Sandra. They don't know that there's an issue there, I would assume, unless he's maybe told them. I don't know. And then, like, he's the chalk pick to win a lot of challenges. He's going to find, like, 15 idols probably, and then he's going to make fire. Like, Boston Rob will actually win at a point. Like, you do have to take him out earlier than late in the game. I honestly do think, like, I totally get what you're saying. Like, yes, Ethan is almost more threatening because he doesn't have what Poverty described as like the billboard, the way that Poverty and Boston Rob do. But I still think like Boston Rob is making you dump out your bags. Like, he's, even if he's in the minority, he's running the camp in a way that Ethan just isn't. And I still think like objectively it makes more sense to take out someone like a Boston Rob or a Poverty who can probably play harder, who have more control, who have more skills are going to end up bringing from like a challenge perspective, from an idol perspective. Ethan's never played with idols. You know, from all of that, for the other, more friends on the other side. But I just think it probably speaks to a lot of what especially Boston Rob is doing. Like, it's more to his credit than like anything that makes a lot of sense, I think.
Yeah, I think it's obviously, as someone who's a fan of the game, you try to make sense of why this hasn't happened. But ultimately, it's sometimes okay to just say, Boston Rob is that good.
Yeah, you know, and he said that a lot of your season. Like, we were like, why is it happening? Yeah, Rob was that good.
Yeah, he's just that good. And something else to consider, you know, sometimes you hear people critiquing the Survivor community, or the Survivor producers rather, that to suggest that like people like Rob are almost helped to the end. There's certainly accusations that in Redemption Island, he was cast with a bunch of people who would like automatically follow him, which is a pretty ludicrous thought if you think about it, because like, how do you make sure that a group of people will follow someone else?
Get them
it seems
to sign
insane
like a form,
to me.
Probably.
Yeah.
Will you let Boston Rob win? Like,
yeah. So, I mean, I don't think that, I think that sometimes the critique has been there, but the credit must be given to the Survivor production crew right now. They are not helping Robin anyway. He's not found any advantage, and I promise he's been looking. And most importantly, the tribe swap hasn't come yet, and it doesn't seem like it's going to come in the next episode. And the last two votes, Rob has been completely vulnerable. And, you know, in the game right now, if we think the game is live, Rob is sitting on the island right now thinking to himself, oh man, I really wish a tribe swap would come because it would change the whole dynamic of the game. It might give him a chance to succeed. And production are aware of that, and they aren't allowing it to happen. You know, they've made these tribes and these guys are sitting tight. If Rob had been in any of the last, what, three seasons, a tribe support would have happened already, and Rob would have been in a much better position as far as I'm concerned than he is right now. But the tribe swap is being delayed because obviously they want to make sure that Rob is being properly tested. And if he needs to go, because the game dictates that, then he needs to go. You know, that's, I think credit must be given to production because the temptation is there to try and switch things up and to allow Rob to find some way to weasel his way through. But right now he's being tested purely on his social and a strategic game.
Yeah, I do think that there are so many things in Survivor that prove it's not rigged, and this, you, I agree, is another one. The fact that they won't swap them, even though it's an episodically very late swap in terms of what we're used to in modern Survivor. Days-wise, we're kind of getting to where they usually swap by latest day 12, and we're only on day 9. We've had so many vote-outs because Amber went on day 3. So day-wise, it will probably kind of line up. Episode-wise, for them not to swap in episode 5 is really, really rare, if not, you know, impossible in modern Survivor. So the fact that Boss and Rob and Parvati are completely on the bottom of their tribes and they're not swapping them just to save them proves a million times over, you know, how much the producers don't do this and don't, you know, try and help out their favorites, because they would definitely be doing it here. But yeah, I definitely agree that with Boss and Rob's reputation, it could be like a Sandra and Game Changers thing. He might have one of his worst outings in terms of placement if he goes sometime soon, but it will just have cemented his legacy as a player like Sandra did in Game Changers. As much as I guess it's just like the bag dumping, even this episode, I know he lost out, I know that he lost his ally, but I like the Adam plan. The fact that he could have Adam come to him, that's on him, that's credit to him.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, it didn't work out, but Ethan was a bigger threat. I totally get it from Jeremy and Michelle's perspective. It makes a lot of sense, but he has thrown Adam under the bus. He tried something. It didn't work. It might work next week if they go for Adam, and that could save him and Parvati to a swap. So he's still making those moves, and I still find it so impressive. But I think we should get to Adam and why he did this, because he's probably the one who's caught the flack. I know you're a big Adam fan. What did you think about this?
See, here's the tricky thing. Was after I played Survivor, I promised myself that I would never again judge a player of Survivor by their performance in the game, because, you know, it's just a game ultimately. But I really have struggled with Adam this season, because I found that he has been quite difficult to watch. You know what Adam is? He's kind of like the top scholar in the class who reminds the teacher to check the homework on a Monday morning. And like, that makes perfect sense. It's logical and it's right. And everything Adam does is logical and right. It's just that I kind of want to see the naughty kids miss out on getting punished for not doing their homework. You know what I mean?
Like, I think Adam, that I should identify with Adam, because like, people should do their homework. Like, I agree.
Sometimes I want to see the class clown get away with it. You know, it's like a fun time. It helps things become varied. And everything Adam has said has been logical, certainly in the first 3 episodes. But it wasn't fun watching him trying to like ask my boy Boston Rob or my boy Ethan or my girl. It wasn't like the most fun in the world to watch the way Adam was operating, because he was so right, but also it was so painful to see happen because I was rooting for the people he was going against. However, there was a bit of an unraveling in his tactics. I'm not sure what his thinking was, and he rationalized it to himself during a confessional. But I kind of got the feeling that Adam is very He's very convinced of his own belief system at this point. And that's okay, because oftentimes your gut is your most important ally in Survivor. But he's very convinced of his ideas at this moment. And he thinks that perhaps if he is to be ultra maneuvering, things will allow him sort of fall into place and he can become the puppet master. And I think we saw that with him going to Boston Rob. He didn't need to do that. You know, there was an easy vote. It would have been probably quite predictable. But Adam decided to shake things up a bit and to try and dear himself to Rob. And I think he just overplayed his hand at that point, and it blew up quite badly in his face. However, I don't think that this is doom and gloom for Adam. I think that obviously he's on the bottom right now, but I think it won't take too much for him to help switch things around. I think his relationship with Denise is still quite strong. The fact that we got a flashback in the last episode to the previous episode where he gave his idol back to Denise, he said, "This is your idol." That's quite an endearing thing to do. You know, that's a really, really good social move, and I think that Denise will appreciate that. So I don't think that Adam is in a bad spot. I think the next obvious vote from Stella is probably going to be Boston Rob or Poverty, as far as I'm concerned. And I think that if that happens, Adam will probably get to a tribe swap and will then find a way to blend in a bit more. I don't think Adam is in a an awful spot right now. I think he's still got quite some way to go to make sure that he can move forward in the game. I just didn't enjoy watching his performance because I think it was fun to watch the old schoolers play, and Adam was the logical but also painful voice to remind me that was not the right thing to do. And I ascribe my own feelings of disappointment to him in the situation.
I do think if they get to a swap, Adam does seamlessly fit into like the one-time player Ivy League alliance of like Yule, Sophie, Wendell, and Nick, of like that really new school one-time player alliance as led by Yule. I feel like he would fit really comfortably there. Those are a lot of really smart players and fans, and I think that that's just like a natural social connection for him. I'm kind of worried about Adam and Denise. I don't know if it's like he did give it back the idol and that was good, but Denise and Adam, like, they've been shown as one of the main pairs from the beginning. But Denise votes, you know, here and doesn't let Adam know what's going on. We see at the very beginning of the episode, Adam says to Denise, I don't know if how much he told her about his plan, but he does say, like, my plan is to vote out Pavi while maintaining relationships with Rob and Ethan. He says Rob trusts him. To me, like, you can read a lot into the scene. I know my brother read into it thinking that he didn't tell her he was going to tell Rob and Ethan about the plan. I read into it thinking that he did say that because he's like, it's risky. Rob, trust me. It's like, what else is he saying if he's not telling her that plan? And what is she thinking he's going to do by saying, I'm going to vote out Pavi but maintain relationships? What else could that possibly mean? So she's the one who's betrayed him the most. And I'm actually kind of concerned for her because he has a lot of information on her. He knows she has the idol. She's the one he's been talking to the most. So he could maybe throw her under the bus and be like, she knew that, like, whether she did or not, like, she knew I was going to go to them and she didn't, you know, tell you that when you found out I told them. So, like, I feel like he's got a lot on her. And if he is desperate and if it is coming towards him, I wonder if he could just kind of, like, throw that back on her. Like, Denise is, you know, like, a therapist and she's great at dealing with all different personality types. Can she bring him back into the fold? Like, I do think that of those four, of Jeremy, Michelle, Ben, and Denise, she suffers the most from betraying Adam here and leaving him in the game. I wonder if there was like another option. Can you try and like, you know, fix that relationship? She is a therapist, like get some couples counseling, be like, Michelle, Ben, Jeremy, Adam, let's get back together. Let's not have this fractured vote. Or, you know, does she just at that point say we have to vote him out outright, back, you know, onto edge of extinction, rather than like leaving her number one ally in the game, who she's just knifed the hardest? Like, how is that relationship going the next day?
That's an interesting point, and I love what you've said there about the relationship with Adam and Denise being quite fractured and the fact that Denise will suffer from it. But there's an opportunity there. You know, you mentioned that Adam perhaps might use his knowledge on Denise to his advantage, but it seems like those left in the Cele tribe are quite logical and they won't really hold Denise liable for having an idol. I don't think it's going to be like, oh, well, Denise is an idol, she's untrustworthy.
Yeah, great,
I think
in fact what might happen. It might not be the reason she goes home, but she wouldn't. I mean, Ben knows it too, but she wouldn't want her idol just outed. And who knows what Adam will do if he's desperate and betrayed.
I agree with you, but my point is that I think that Adam will come off worse if he tries to throw Denise under the bus for that than Denise will look. I think Adam will reaffirm the fact that he's the number one target. And I think that if he's going to try and ask Denise after it's quite clear that these two are working, I mean, I'm not sure if it's clear to the rest of them, but it's certainly clear to us that these two are working together. It can be assumed that there's a knowledge of these two working together and having a good relationship still. If Adam now wants to try and disrupt Denise's game, I think it'll come off as frenetic. And I think it will certainly make that target on his back a little bit bigger. If Adam wants to avoid scrutiny right now, the best thing he could do is humbly approach Denise and say sorry and try his best to like blend in as best as possible. Because I think if he's going to go any harder right now, he's going to burn out. It becomes a really obvious target because you know, I always say like Survivor is a bit like a sniper rifle. You don't know how many shots you have in your barrel because you can only take so many shots before you eventually run out. And sometimes, you know, like Tony in Kagyan had a rifle that had a million rounds in it and could just take shots all day, every day, and somehow still won. But Adam, I don't think, has that many rounds available in his rifle, and he needs to be very cautious about how he plays it right now, because if he's going to try and ask Denise or if he's going to try and continue to rally people against Boston Rob or poverty, it's not going to come off as very sincere. I think it's going to come off as quite frenetic. In saying that, I know I shouldn't read too much into it because I'm not good at this, but when I watch the next time on Survivor, you know, the preview for the next episode, it seemed to me like they were kind of hyping up this whole thing of Adam being the person to go. But then the next transition was into the Dakal tribe. And I have a feeling that Dakal will lose the next immunity challenge, because I just think that the Adam narrative is quite obvious. They're going to sell that to us, but I don't see that coming to fruition next episode. I think that we probably will see Dakal losing a challenge, and then we'll need to see the way the red tribe then operates, because I just don't think that I don't know what it is about the situation. I just don't see Adam leaving yet. I think he is in a difficult spot, and he has quite.
So that seems like a main character.
Yeah. Absolutely. Just from analyzing the editing and stuff like that. And also his pregame press has been insane. Like I messaged you on Twitter and I said to you that I think Adam's going to go really far because of the way that he's been hyping it up online.
To be fair, I would say the person hyping it up the most was Ethan, to be fair. And you all.
But perhaps Ethan returns. You know, that's something else to chat about later on. I think Ethan could potentially be a returnee, because I agree with you. I think that if you had a bad season, you're less likely to buy too much into it online. I just don't think that if Adam had blown out in the next episode, you know, if things go badly for Adam and he's voted out next, I'd be really surprised, because it wouldn't be a great showing for him. Does that make sense? Like, he wouldn't have had a great season, and he would have known that, and he would have been hyping up the season, which obviously is exciting, but I don't think he would have been as excited as he has shown to be online simply by, you know, getting voted out in the next episode. I think his story has a lot more that needs to be discussed. And so for me, logically speaking, even though Jeremy and Michelle have spoken in the preview about him needing to go, I don't think it's going to happen in the near future. I think he's got quite a good spot that he's occupying.
Yeah, I mean, I can't analyze the social media stuff. I'm not good at that. I'm more of an edit analyzer. From that perspective, I don't think Adam's going, from like an edit perspective. But look, it would be worst case scenario for him to then be throwing Denise under the bus and saying, like, I don't know. Like, it's kind of different for me. Like, did she know that he was going to tell Rob and Ethan, or was she only vaguely indicated that that was going to happen? Because if she actually knew, he really does have a lot of dirt on her. And that would be my guess, yes, that she knew. But like, no, I only think he's doing that if he's like going home and knows it, and it's just like that point, just like kamikaze. But like, the best case scenario is that this was, which was one of the tightest alliances in the game, is now fractured. Even if they get back on the same page, it's not the same as what it was going to be. It doesn't seem like it's going to be as tight of a long-term alliance. I mean, she just left him out of the vote when he was coming to her with his plans, when he just gave her back her half of the idol. Yeah. I do think that that is fractured. I don't know if Denise had a great option. I mean, her ally did something a little crazy. Her other allies weren't into it. Maybe they don't like you inserting yourself and trying to, like, you know, get them back together and kind of trying to fix that relationship. But you also maybe don't want to, like, completely lose them from the game. Even if you do want to lose them from the game, it looks like she didn't have, like, the strategic input to make that decision. It was Jeremy and Michelle. So it does seem like she was just in a bad spot. Yeah. But I do think that she loses the most because she's lost this very tight relationship, at least from what it was. And even if they get back on the same page, it's still, you know, it's like what they say, like, you know, you drop glass and try to put it back together, but you still see the cracks. And that's what I see from their relationship. But like, in terms of Adam, like, I see some logic in what he was trying to do. He's scared of Boston Rob, who can blame him? And like, something like Edge of Extinction makes you want to play a little bit more conservatively, I think. Like, I think Sandra said as much apparently in the first tribal council and in some of the news articles about it. It was like, you can't hurt people as much because they might come back. And Boston Rob especially probably is odds on favorite to come back. So he's probably just trying to keep everyone on side. A swap is coming. He doesn't want like the two most powerful people in the game, or at that point would be Boston Rob and Ethan, you know, coming for him or mad at him. So he's trying to like keep them on side. I think that that does make sense. But where it doesn't make sense was just going against all his other allies. And we didn't see him tell anyone except maybe Denise, but they were obviously all quite shocked. So doing it really individually, showing your other allies that basically you're playing your own game, you don't care about them. You're fine if Boston Rob and Ethan feel like they've betrayed them, but you just want yourself covered. It's like a very selfish way to play the game. And you're also, all you're banking on is that no one talks to each other except to you. Like, it just takes one conversation between Rob and Ethan or anyone on the other side to have that all go completely out the window. So I think he really did underestimate, obviously, his own relationships and his opponents in thinking that. I just think he had like a very like one-dimensional kind of self-centered view of the game, which was like, these are people as they relate to me, and so this will work, rather than being like, they could have conversations while I'm not around at all, and then this will all blow up spectacularly, which is what it did. So that was kind of the problem with the move.
Yeah. It was a surprising thing. And I think obviously you want to make sure that you're kind in the way you assess things, because we don't know the full story. We don't know what Adam's logic was. And we know he's a smart guy. He's won Survivor before. He's a good player. But if we get to be blunt about it, it wasn't an enjoyable thing to see happen. I think you kind of imagine that this early on in the game, you would see some sort of loyalty to an alliance, because it's logical at this point. You know, it doesn't make too much sense to try to break the game this early. And I think if he had spoken candidly to some of the other cast members in his alliance, he would have been able to achieve his goals pretty easily, you know. I don't think anyone would have been like too resistant to the fact that Adam's taking the wheel, but he went about it in a really strange way, and it's hard to try and make sense of why the decision was made. Like, I don't know why Adam would do that. I still doesn't make sense to me, because he's a smart man, he's a good player. What he did wasn't exactly like that intelligent, and it's put him on the back foot. And you then mentioned Denise and the fact that she's lost most from it. I think, first of all, it's interesting because there's a cross-season reference again here. Denise played this amazing game and she was so close to Malcolm, and it made this beautiful narrative of these two people going to the end together. And we can see that bond still exists right now, because Malcolm is busy tweeting about it every single second of every single episode. It's really great. Like, it's wholesome. The relationship is obviously a really strong one, and we appreciate that. Denise, on day one, is taken back to that by Adam. She's made to feel like this is the next thing. And I don't blame her feeling that that was the way forward for her, because it was presented as the way forward from Adam. So it was like, okay, cool. Here's a repeat of what's happened. This is what I know. I'm going to stick to this for now because I'm a one-time player. Now she's been put in a scenario where she's been mistreated by her alliance partner, her Malcolm of the season, supposedly. How does she then handle that? You know, how does she manage to negotiate her position at the bottom of a tribe without that same loyalty? Can she find a way forward? As far as I can tell, this is a great metric, a great test for Denise. This is what we've been waiting for. You know, so far we've seen Kim not being able to emulate her one world game in any way, shape, and form. There she was, like, so cool all the way through. Here she was immediately in the firing line. Here's the next test. Can Denise withstand this? And I think that's what makes this so beautiful, is that we know her history. We know she attended every single tribal council. We know she was a member of Matt Singh and she survived that. All these things were really important beats in the career path of Denise to winning Survivor. But how does it go now, where the same thing has sort of repeated itself? We've seen the same echo. We've seen like a sense of foreshadowing. And now that has been broken, and it's her on her own, and she has to rebuild. And I think it's just a beautiful payoff for many Denise fans. Because, like, I'm not a diehard Denise fan. I haven't watched their season, I'm not going to lie. Like, I've followed the trajectory of it, but I never watched the season. I wasn't big into it. But I know she's deeply beloved by many people. She is, like, a classic, all-time great. How does she do now? This is the big test for me.
Yeah, I mean, well, like, it was Adam's the one, like, he seemed to stay loyal to her. He seemed to tell her plans, and she betrayed him. Like, definitely you can't recapture the magic of Malcolm and Denise, because they didn't have this many problems until, like, day 38, as they're having in 9 days. Yeah. So, yeah, you can't get that back. There's a reason that you can't just be her Malcolm. It is tricky for her. I think that at a point, it's going to be how she, as this unbelievable social player, as a therapist, can come back and deal with Adam. And I've seen Adam be on the wrong side of a vote early on in the game, and I've seen him sulk about it on the Mari vote. And I'm interested to see, like, how she, because she's the main one who's going to have to come back. I hope we see that scene and handle Adam and kind of try and put the glass pieces back together as much as you can see the fractures. And she has the hardest job doing that, but I do think she has the best skills to do it. So I don't doubt it. Like,
yeah,
I think she can. For Adam, like, yeah, I mean, I got some of his logic. If he goes to his allies and is like, look, Boston Rob is coming back from Edge of Extinction. Whatever we do, he's a part of our long-term game. Let's not make him hate us. Maybe they're like, dude, that's crazy. We have to blindside Parvati. Or maybe they're like, okay, fine. If you want to take that on, they probably are like, we should blindside Parvati, as everyone has outlined why you should blindside Rob. Even Rob was like, definitely blindside me, right? But like, at least you've taken it to them. At least you've like pitched the logic, which does exist to them. And then they don't feel so betrayed. Yeah, I mean, it was pretty crushing, like, from Adam. He always got the confessional of, like, it's tricky, but I think it'll work. Cut to Ethan and Boston Rob being like, that was terrible. He's completely misread that. And that just shows, like, how off book he was with this. Just the bad read.
Yeah, there was, like, also a tiny bit of hubris in it. The fact that he was like, I think Boston Rob should play more like me, was put in there quite intentionally, I think, because it was such a strong juxtaposition as to what actually happened. We had this expectation that Adam was, like, going to be this person who creates this you know, he's going to use his new school techniques to oust Boston Rob. And it just like, it blew up quite badly in his face. So there was a bit of like, it wasn't a great look for him in the edit, to be honest with you. They kind of made him seem like he had some hubris, like he was a bit overconfident, and it's been quite humbling for him. But also it presents an opportunity. You know, he suffered this fate early on. Can he find a way to blend his way back into the game and get deeper in? I think Adam's going to get really far. I still maintain that. I'm not excited about it because I didn't enjoy his behavior in the first four episodes at all. But I think he's going to get really, really far. I think he's in a bad spot right now, but I don't think it's untenable. I think, you know, Boston Rob, for example, is in a bad spot, but there's no real way he can move forward beyond a tribe swap or finding an idol or something like that. Adam has got lots of options to open to him. And he can certainly, while not relying on the relationship with Denise exclusively, he can sort of find his way into an alliance in the near future, which I think will carry him a bit deep into the game. Certainly, if there's going to be a tribe swap, it'll help blur the lines a bit. And even if he has been quite abrasive thus far, I don't think he's the immediate target in a tribe swap scenario.
Well, I actually do want to talk about Dekal, you know, trying to get to this other tribe, because I actually don't think that they are going to go to a tribal council before a swap, which I assume will be the episode after next. Just because, okay, like all of the stuff is Tyson v. Sandra, that's what we're getting. But I just think that, like, tribes like this where they don't go back to tribal council, the strategy ends up being a bit vague. And that's what this kind of was. It was like,
yeah,
you know, obviously Tyson's been on the bottom from the Amber vote. He's going to throw Sandra under the bus. It just makes sense. None of us thought she would last long, being like the person always has to sit out of challenges, although now she does have that opportunity to do that. And just being the queen, like, it just makes sense. But like, it's kind of basic strategy. It's kind of vague. And you just have Yule in the middle kind of talking it out, and, oh, you know, I don't believe for a second that it's, oh, well, Sandra caught us a shark, so now she's not going home. I'm sure there's a million things going through his mind.
Yeah,
and I just don't think any of this is, like, specific enough to be building up to a big vote. I don't think we're seeing this iteration of the tribe go back to tribal.
That's fair, and that's actually a really good analysis of the editing thus far, because that makes perfect sense. It was interesting to me that Yul decided to reveal Tyson's plan to Sandra.
Well, yeah, he still is Team Sandra. Like, because that's what with the edit, you can hear a million confessionals, but it's like actions speak louder than words, and his actions were like, "I'm Team Sandra." Yeah. He told her the plan.
Yeah, it was weird to me because whatever Yul's doing, I'm probably gonna be like, "That's a good idea." Because Yul in episode one kind of showed me exactly how good he is. Like, he's just remarkably intelligent. He's so good. He's a driving force, and it was again reaffirmed in episode two and in episode three. And so I just think he's a really, 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 really sound player, even though his confessional was just the breadfruit. Like, oh, his piece in the previous episode was just the breadfruit. The way he spoke about the breadfruit was like really engaging to me. I was like, get the breadfruit, bro. Yeah, that's a great tactic. Use that hoop thing. Reach up high. Do your thing. Because he's just so good at everything. He's such a remarkable survivor player. And I think it's a shame this is only his second time playing, because he's so good. Like, you almost step back and think, wow, this guy is the real deal.
Yeah.
So in the Yul situation, I think that right now it's intriguing to me that he's chosen to side with Sandra. As you said, actions speak louder than words, and he's chosen to side with Sandra, which is weird to me because, you know, Sandra has won twice and she was great in Game Changers, and she very clearly is a really, really good player. Tyson, on the other hand, is at the bottom and he's kind of like trying to fight his way up, and he's a great player as well, but I don't think he's got the same caliber as Sandra. And to see Yul deciding to side with Sandra was intriguing to me, and I wonder what the justification behind that was. Was it a situation of an alliance being formed early on that we weren't given its information on? Maybe it wasn't included in the edits. How did this happen? I don't know. It's intriguing to me, and I want to see how it unfolds, because there must be a payoff at some point. You know, the fact that it was shown one small beat in an episode, it was referenced, there must be some sort of payoff later on. Maybe Yul decides to add a trap or blindside Sandra or something, or maybe protects her. We're not sure how it's going to work, but it's an interesting beat, and I'm intrigued to see what happens from this point onward, because it was kind of unnecessary in the context of the episode, so I'm wondering why it was included.
Yeah, I mean, like, as I've said, I feel like it's still vague. Like, he does tell Sandra, he probably is more on Team Sandra, but we're not seeing more of the conversations with Tyson. It's like, is he just sowing discontent in general? Like, maybe the Sandra thing is kind of what you were saying with Robin Parvati. Like, maybe she winning, like, she going out at a point is actually inevitable. Like, in a way that I don't actually feel that Robin Parvati is, because she's not going to be saving herself with challenges. She's not coming back from Edge of Extinction. They're not letting Sandra get to the end and win. Yeah. So, like, that's inevitable. And Tyson is actually, like, a huge threat in pretty much every way. Getting back with Rob is clearly something you would be scared about with the Poker Alliance. He's a physical threat. He's, like, every type of threat. So in terms of threatening, Tyson, I think, is actually a much bigger threat to win than Sandra. But, like, I don't know if there'll be payoff. I genuinely don't, because if they, like, okay, maybe they'll go to Tribal, but if they don't, like, this just made sense to me to kind of show the dynamics. The dynamics are Tyson's on the bottom of one side, then you've got Sandra on the other side, they're throwing each other under the bus, Yule's a referee in the middle with complete control. Like, it doesn't have to pay off, they just need to show you Dekal in this episode, and it's a really good way to be like, what is happening? It's like, those are the very broad tribe dynamics, and also, like, for some reason, Tony's putting ash on Sarah's face. Like, that's what's happening at Dekal, and it's like a good way to kind of sum that up in the short amount of time that they have.
Yeah, it's actually been such a pleasant thing that we've seen Soleil unravel and we've seen Dekal remain strong. I mean, I'm not sure what would have happened if it would be more entertaining had Dekal lost more challenges thus far. But it's allowed us to really enjoy Tony, because I think Tony was probably one of the most threatening players going into the season. Beyond Sandra and Boston Rob and Poverty, I think Tony was like right there with him, because he was just so good in Kagiyan and he was so wild in Game Changes. And the fact that he's been allowed to play this game for a couple of days and be as funny as he is, it's been really, really nice, because he's been so good. And he's also been quite a good player. I mean, from what we've seen so far, he's managed to avoid the temptation to go and hunt for idols. He's managed to build some relationships. Him and Sarah, which I didn't really expect to see it like this. You know, the two previous times they played, it hadn't worked out too well for them. They're playing together for the third time now, and they clearly have got a really good relationship. Sarah went straight to Tony and was like, listen, this is my advantage. It's time to go hunt for a steal a vote. That is quite a private piece of information, and it shows that their relationship is really, really good. So I'm glad in some way that the Carl hasn't been tested, because it's allowed us to see characters like Tony, like Yul, like Kim to some extent, kind of being tested, but not really facing any consequence thus far.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're in a good spot from that, because they've been able to bond and have fun without having to go to Tribal, you know, have these fractures. I mean, the other tribe just had a 4-3-1 vote. That's a lot, you know. Then and in that four, Michelle and Jeremy have also been blindsided, so they've all backstabbed each other. Whereas, like, Amber was pretty painless. It was like pretty much unanimous. Once Tyson and Kim got on board, so like they've been able to chill, have fun with the ladder. And that's really good for them as a tribe. And like, even though we've been able to see less of them, I have to say, like, yeah, where Tony's sitting is like beyond a dream as a Tony fan of what we ever could have thought. The fact that like all the craziness is outside of the game. Every moment with Tony is pure joy. I mean, the latter thing is its own thing. The fact that he's like leading Sarah through the dark with this like stick. Like, imagine if he hits someone with that stick. What is the plan there? It just hits the cameraman with it. The fact that we're going into it and Tony doesn't seem like he's in trouble, and he's so fun, and he's had the time, as Sarah said, for everyone to love him, and that's how he gets his hooks in. And it's honestly like too good to be true. Like, I'm so happy.
Yeah, I it's almost like you don't want to fall into the fever dream of thinking you might actually stand a chance of winning again.
I don't think you can win, but I'm just going to take what I can get.
Yeah, every time you see him on screen, though, you think, jeepers, he's still here, man. Perhaps Tony might find a few idols. Perhaps he might cause some trouble. And then the seed begins to become planted, and then it begins to become watered, and then the seed begins to sprout. And I've got this dangerous hope that Tony might get quite far, even though it's so unlikely to happen. Even if Dekal were to go to Tribal at this point, if they were to lose the next challenge, I don't know if Tony would be the first person to go anymore. You know, that was the initial thought was, yeah, I don't think anyone's thinking, okay, well, Tony right now is like almost, he's dooting it up, and he's managed to really negate his threat level really, really well. And he's also, he's completely self-aware. And the fact that he's got to refer back to why he's not looking for idols all the time is so great. Like, it's such an evolution of who he is in the game that he's played. And I think it's been a real joy to see him here. And I listened to a podcast before this season started, and some people were talking about the fact that he wasn't really, in their minds, a legendary player. I think Tony is just like so great. I think if I was to make a tribe of the greatest legends of all time, Tony would be in there, because he's been so cool this far in the season. And it'd be interesting to see how he goes from here on in. And you know what's great? Many of the threats that we mentioned early on are still in the game, and they're still in contention. So it means that if you do have a medium threat level, you have a good chance of finding a way through. You know, we speak about all these players. We talk about people who can't win. There's only so many players left in the game. You know, there's only 16 people left and then two returnees from Edge of Extinction. But there are only so many spots open and there are only so many votes that can happen. And sooner or later, we're going to realize that someone with a massive threat level is going to get through and is going to get quite deep into the game. And that's what's really intriguing. Who's it going to be? Is it going to be more than one person? Are we going to see a vote soon where we might actually see someone who has a low threat level being voted out, because that's just the way the cards tumble, because sometimes that happens. You know, perhaps we might see an obscure vote happen, and we might see a removal of someone who seems like completely dormant right now, like a Sophie or something. We don't know what might happen in the near future. So I think the deeper we get into the game, the more exciting it's becoming, because players like Tony, players like Sandra, players like Boston Rob, they're still there, and that means there's a chance. You know, perhaps they might win three challenges in a row and get deep into the game, and then the cards fall in their favor. It is getting, it's sort of like taking shape now in a way that I didn't think it would. I thought Tony would have been out by now, and that's exciting to me.
Yeah, I mean, well, Tony has never won a challenge, but he could find idols. And look, he's joy personified. Like, genuinely, it's crazy how much I love so many of these players, if not almost all of them. And I, like, definitely love Tony the most. Like, it's not close as well, which is that it's actually sick how much I love Tony Blackos. But I want to talk about this mission that Tony was not at all helpful in at all. I feel like he was so superfluous outside of just being hysterically funny. But to go back to Edge of Extinction, right, why Sarah was doing this crazy thing, what are you thinking about the way that Edge of Extinction has kind of manifested itself through four episodes of season 40?
Look, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm sorry to say this, Shannon, you're going to be angry with me after this, but I didn't mind Edge of Extinction.
Okay,
I'm so sorry. I didn't want to say it out loud, and I was nervous about it. I knew we were going to fight about this, but I didn't mind it. I thought it was actually quite cool. And the reason is because for me, like, the first season I watched after I'd taken a break of watching Survivor before I played was Pearl Islands, because I loved Rupert. And in that, there were the outcasts who came back into the game. Yeah. And at the point, I felt like it wasn't a bad thing. I was like, okay, if this is what they decided to do, then that's the nature of Survivor. And then Lil was back in the game, but obviously it was great because Lil didn't win, and it would have been a bit of a shame had she won in that situation. I think then the Edge of Extinction thing would have been a bit more hurtful to me. But then I watched Edge of Extinction, and I thought it was interesting to see how, you know, people were interacting on the island. And I think the worst part about it for me was seeing, like, Joe on Edge of Extinction, knowing he wasn't going to get back. It was just, like, depressing, you know. It wasn't fun to see that. It was upsetting. But the idea of it, the sentiment, was cool to me. And I think that because I loved Rick Devon so much, Rick Devon is like an iconic player for me. It validated its existence for me. And so I missed the hype. I was playing Survivor when Edge of Extinction was airing. So I didn't really like know how much it was hated, so I watched it with an open mind, and I was not like, oh man, this is ruining the game. It was kind of okay for me. And when Chris won, it wasn't like, obviously it was heartbreaking, but I wasn't like, this is an indictment on the legacy of Survivor, because it was, I felt like in the past I'd been more disappointed. Like when Natalie White won over Russell Hunt, I was just like, oh man, this is not fun. This is worse than Edge of Extinction. So for me, it wasn't like, I wasn't hateful towards it. And I think the fact that there's now the incorporation of some currency it's not well received thus far, but I'm kind of enjoying the fact that these people who are out of the game are allowed an opportunity to have some bearing on it. I think there's one important thing to note about this Edge of Extinction iteration is that I hope it's the last one, because I know it's like, it's not worth it. It's like, it's not a nice payoff, because the consequences on the whole game are too severe. So I wouldn't like it to see it repeated, but I'm happy that it's here right now, because in some way, players like Danny, players like Amber, players like Ethan, who are now on Edge of Extinction, last played so long ago that it's almost like they are now on a return season in some way. So the same way that like a person can make a mistake in one season and come back to play three seasons later, perhaps if you take someone like Jeremy, he clearly made a mistake when he played in San Juan del Sur in some ways, and he came back with a vengeance and in second chances and played again and won. I think it's kind of like that for me in some way, because Amber was like nowhere tactically. She had no idea what was going on. She was like completely distanced from the tribe and the tactics of what was going on in the game. But now she's seen it firsthand. She suffered the consequences. And now she's on Edge of Extinction, where hopefully she can like meditate on what's happened and develop an understanding of it. And then she might just come back and it will be like a second chance for her to play in the same season, if that makes sense. So I think that's the one redeeming factor, is that it allows players who haven't played in a very, very long time and are playing at an extremely high level a chance to meditate on what's gone down. And hopefully the people who return are going to learn from their mistakes, and it might actually redeem it in this context. And then going back to the question about what Edge of Extinction means for the season, I don't think the advantages of a Steeler vote right now is that consequential. I think, you know, it's obviously was put to great use in Game Changers with Michaela, but it hasn't really come to fruition in US Survivor again since that point. It has been consequential sometimes. Of course, we've seen similar situations in Dev vs. Goliath with advantages of that nature coming to play and being really consequential. I just don't think that I would have taken that if I was Sarah. Like, to exchange your one fire token for that is a bit of a bold move. But in terms of the way that it was conducted by the production crew, where like you could see them sneaking into this camp, and you can see the people like sort of shuffling in their sleep as they hear Sarah knocking over torches, it was like a great TV moment, and I really enjoyed that. And for me, it adds an enjoyable element into the game to watch. I don't think it's like the worst thing in the world.
Well, I actually think, like, in terms of Amber and Danny's legacy and like them meditating on it, I think like Edge of Extinction has made them look worse. Like, the way they were outplayed so hard by Nat here, and then weren't even wanting to like they were like, oh, I don't even want to go back there ever again. It's like, well, what else are you doing on Edge of Extinction? Like, I understand it's frustrating, but at least keep trying. So I don't think it's been that great for their gameplay or their legacy in that. In terms of, like, my updating feelings on Edge of Extinction, I have not changed. And Ethan Zahn is there. And I still would rather a pure game without Edge of Extinction. But I have accepted it. I do think that it's very powerful. Like, the way that Nat, and I do love Nat, and I'm happy for her to always have success. Like, the way that she is killing it, you know, it's basically like a big escape room at this point, which is more exciting than a treasure hunt, but I would definitely rather devote the time to tribe dynamics in the actual game. So it's like kind of in the middle there, in terms of like random irrelevant treasure hunt and like actual survivor. It's like an escape room where you have to use your smarts is probably in the middle. But yeah, I mean, it's a lot of power. And I think that Nat's been playing it so well. Like, the fact that she obviously always finds and works out these clues is great. The fact that she is sending it to different people, I think, is really smart, because if she loads up on Jeremy, he could get voted out and all of those advantages don't matter. She could get in and then Jeremy's like too powerful. I mean, at that point, she still has to play the game, and she's like really made a very threatening person very powerful. And she has like a completely clear understanding of who has what fire tokens, who has what advantages. She's made like a bunch of different connections. She's not like making anyone too powerful. And if she gets back in the game, she'll have people who want to work with her. So she's put herself in the best possible spot. It's actually insanely powerful. Like, imagine if Amber was crushing it the way that Nat is, Boston Rob would be invincible, because Amber would just be sending it to Boston Rob. And I think that this is the way the game should be played, with one person in the game, one person on Extinction, and you could run the table pretty much by yourself. So yeah, I mean, Edge of Extinction, as I've said, is like a very, very powerful place to be, and like even more so now, where pretty much it seems every episode is another opportunity to earn a fire token, to give someone an advantage. That's influence on the game, that's power coming into your pocket. Like, the amount of power that Nat has played with in the first three episodes, and it seems like we'll continue to play with if she can keep on the streak, is enormous. So that's crazy. I agree with you, though, that Sarah spending the fire token on a Steeler vote, I mean, the Mandela effect of her Steeler vote, they said it, that she played it successfully in Game Changes. That's not how I remember it, and that's not how it happened. Like most Steeler votes, except for David versus Goliath, I think it was numerically irrelevant. She would have won the vote without it. So yeah, I would be keeping my fire token for like an idol. What is the consistency of currency? You get an idol for three tribal councils with a token, but then you also have to buy the opportunity to sneak into someone's camp for a Steeler vote with a token. Those things seem like they should not be the same price.
Yeah, the economics aren't really worked out.
Yeah, Sarah got ripped off
on Edge of Extinction.
Yeah.
Yeah, I felt the same way. It's kind of like it was sort of the same as when we're watching Island of the Idols, and some of the advantages were just absurd. Like the thing of getting a pencil to write an advantage on a piece of paper was more of a hindrance to Jamal than it was a benefit. So I think that sometimes the advantages are incorrectly geared, and you got to question the balance of things, because it was kind of like the same question for me on Island of Secrets. If someone went to Island of Secrets and either got wood or sweets, because they arrived there, or someone gets an idol, a full strength idol, like, how do you know when what's the metric? Like, when do you use a powerful advantage? When do you get one? How does it work? I don't know. That doesn't really make sense. But an interesting point about Sarah Steele vote is that you are right. Like, it didn't have any real consequence in the game, and she, I don't know if it could be that useful right now, and I'm not sure when it might be useful. In saying that, like, that, you know, she does have some power on Edge of Extinction, but I think there's an inbuilt issue with the fact that she can't sell the same advantage to the same person over and over again.
Well, so,
like,
she
all
can.
The different advantages to the same person. No, because, like, because Jeremy would, if she sold it to Jeremy, he only had one fire token, so it would have been
unlikely. Well, yeah, no, he had two because she gifted him one, so then she could have given it to him. Okay. But yeah, she has said on Twitter that she gave it to Sarah because she thought Sarah being a cop would be, like, up for the heist. But yeah, I mean, yeah, you only have one fire token at that point, Sarah. Like, I would be saving it for something that feels more valuable than a steal a vote, which is, like, again, these extra votes, these steal a votes are just very overrated advantages.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I think that, like, we were very, like, Sandra was super lucky that she managed to get the temporary idol, even though it wasn't used. That was a really fortunate one. If I was Sarah and I was rewatching it and I saw that Sandra had gotten a three tribal council strong immunity idol, I've been really upset. I've been like, what is this nonsense? I snuck out of camp. I nearly risked my life. And
if it was advantage, like, what?
Yeah,
the currency is so confused. Like, I don't understand. Like, it makes sense. Like, okay, when you go to Island of Secrets, Island of the Idols, what, like, you get different things that have to be diverse. Okay, that's fair. But imagine if you have to pay for it. It's like, why is this jar of sweets the same price as, like, seeing a loved one? Like, why? Like, the currency is all messed up. And definitely the currency should be that it's not just one token. Like, how is this not coming to effect yet? The way that they have shared idols, because they want people to make it social, the way to make that ingrained in the game and not put in too many advantages is to just have them come only from Edge of Extinction, but have them cost three fire tokens, so you have to collaborate. It makes so much sense. I don't know why they are. I mean, I think at a point it's going to get more expensive, but it should have started that way. It's, like, too cheap. One token? That's so easy. Like, you get a token. You should have, you know, it should have been, you have to, you know, Sarah then has to bring in Tony to buy it. Like, that would be fun. That would be social.
But even if you had to see a fire token stock being given after a challenge or whatever, or maybe hidden around camp the same way that an idol is, you then have a situation of people teaming up with each other to try and get a common goal achieved to buy one certain thing or the next. But I guess this is all still teething problems, and I'm actually surprised that this was included in Winners at War and not in an earlier season or in a later season. Like, it's a weird place for them to start with fire tokens. I think... Yeah, it makes sense that, you know, Age of Extinction as a season was probably put there as a means to test it out for Winners at War, because that was the eventual goal. But if we look at fire tokens, I would imagine that it would have been probably a season theme, considering they're in the same place over and over again. You could have made, like, a Survivor season of fire tokens. That makes sense.
Definitely. Like, I've always thought that.
Yeah, so it's a weird thing to me that they decided to bring it in now at this, like, really crucial moment. But I don't think it's, like, taking away too much from the game, and I think it is adding an extra layer because we do get to see people who are voted out having some bearing on the game. And I think it's been fun to see, like, the way that Natalie's rationalized things, and we can clearly see that she, you know, she's still in it. Although she was voted out first, she's not, like, dismayed by it. She's not too upset. She's making moves, and I think that Natalie is someone who's strong. Like, she's very, very, very strong, and I wouldn't be surprised if she was to win a return challenge to get back into the game. I think we can safely imagine that probably Danny and Amber aren't the most likely people to win, but Natalie's strong, and I think that she might be a serious contender to get back into the game. And at that point, you know, she'll be quite unstoppable, which will be quite a cool thing to see happen, because it would have been quite poetic in the fact that she was voted out first after her sister was voted out first, and there was a motivation to win San Juan del Sur. So I'm kind of gunning for her. I hope she does really, really well, and I hope she uses these advantages that she's gained to re-enter the game in some way.
Yeah, I mean, the way that she smashed the shells as well, like, she just, it's actually kind of embarrassing how much she ran circles around of Danny and Amber in this episode.
And Danny was like, I never want to go back there in my life. I hate it there. Defeated.
Yeah, I mean, Danny, what else are you doing on Edge of Extinction? Like, I'm sure you will find the time to try this again. Like, that is crazy. And now a quick break to hear from our sponsors. And we are back. All right, so I want to get to the chizzy. Give some points to these people. So take it away, Jacob Sager Weinstein and MC Color.
One,
1, 2, 3. Okay, so the chizzy, I think, is at least a little bit self-explanatory for me this week. I'm definitely giving 3 points to Michelle. As I've said, the best move I've ever seen her make on Survivor. So impressive in so many ways. And something I haven't said about it is how much I loved how she reacted to being confronted by Rob, which was the best line in the episode, where he was like, they were like, oh, we're just talking about, should we vote out Ben? And he was like, never mind that. I know that's fake. Was just like so intense. But she was like, she didn't give any information. He's like, I know what's up. She's like, okay, what's up? You tell me, because I'm not giving you anything. And then she and Jeremy like both placated him, obviously enough for him to actually think they were going with Adam and be blindsided. And then they continue to have their own conversation and make their own choice. So she was just social butterfly, strategic queen this episode. Jeremy, 2 points, as we've discussed, also in on the move, doing exactly what he needs to do to kind of hide behind Michelle strategically, because he's the bigger threat. And for the 1 point, I don't know if everyone would agree with this, but I'm definitely giving it to Boston Rob. Like, the fact that he wasn't the second target when they couldn't go for Parvati is just crazy to me. As I've said, every question we ask of why not just take up Boston Rob is not an accident. It's a lot of it probably on him for whatever he's doing, for whatever he's offering. That is a credit to him. And I do wonder next week if Adam is still in a bad spot. You know, that could be the lifeline he and Parvati need to get through to a swap. And it seems like Parvati would even go before him. So it seems like he might be getting to Tyson or to a swap. And that is crazy. Honorable mention I will give to Tony for being the best person in the world. And I want to call out Ben. Like, I've been surprised, and I think other people have been surprised, that so much of my Twitter game for Survivor 40 has been focused on defending Ben, on my defense, which I did in the first Survivor Global, not just like on who he is as a player in this season, but like he's just so down on his first game. And how much is it like he actually believes the internet? How much is he playing it up? It's probably both things. But like, even in Tribal Council, how he was like, this alliance thing is new to me. Like, dude, you were in an alliance for a month. You actually led an alliance for a month of HHH, probably slightly over a month, to be honest. So I think that he's too down on his game. He's too down on his social and strategic chops in this season, probably, and generally. He, as I've said about Ben, like, the twist has made him a bad winner because people think that he didn't deserve it because Fire was unfair, which it was, and the idol stuff, no one liked that. Genuinely, if he'd never found an idol and gone out at 7, I truly believe we'd look back at him as a great player. I've always thought the sweet spot would be to play, absolutely, have played one idol at 7 and to be voted out at 6, he'd be seen as like a Rob legend. And even if he played 3 idols and Fire wasn't introduced and he went home at the final 4, we'd look at him as like a Rob god. I really do believe that. But because he won, like, he's become synonymous with this twist that everyone hates. And I do believe he is a lower tier winner, but I do believe he's still a great, great player. And that gets lost because of the controversy and the anger around his win. So it's not a chizzy point, but I just felt like I couldn't get past this podcast without my defense, which I think might be like my running theme of Survivor 40 to everyone's surprise, including my own. So those are my chizzy points, but what do you want to do?
I am completely in agreement with you. I think that Ben is someone who deserves a lot of credit here, because like, it's kind of depressing seeing how unhappy he is with his own performance in HHH. And I don't get that, because that was the hand he was dealt, and
the internet.
He did the best he could. He's not to blame for it. You know, he did what he could under the circumstances. And I'm just glad that he's having a chance to now play again and to show his mettle to everybody else.
His game has been like so morphed by the internet. It's kind of crazy to me. Like,
yeah,
it's like, do you really not think you were in an alliance? Like, there's no way that your memory is that bad. Like, there's no way that we can have like have done this to you as social media at large, because don't you remember all your alliances? Like, I wonder how much is him and how much he's playing it up, but I'd be interested to know.
I think he probably is really affected by it. It's a bit of a weird thing how you can get your reality and your perception distorted by the world around you. Sometimes you forget these things, man. It's like a long time ago that he played last, and he's been told over and over again that he was an inferior winner. In terms of life events, I mean, it's the subtlety of it's lost on you. Like, oftentimes I remember, like, I played a year ago, and sometimes I remember things like, oh, wait, that didn't happen, did it? And then I get confused and stuff. So I don't blame him for forgetting these sort of things, but I'm glad that he's having a chance to like regain some confidence. And I hope the community at large is making sense of the fact that Ben is actually a really, really strong player, and just also a great character. Like, he's so fun.
So good.
He's awesome. I'm a huge fan of him.
So necessary for the season, for like the color of the cast, like in just terms of like just the variance. Like, they're not all these, like, bosses. Like, just even, like, the little dancing and the goofiness. We definitely had some questions of, like, is he the Drow of the season? Like, we needed this little bit of variation, of weirdness, of quirkiness, of strangeness. And it happened to come through Ben and Tony. But, like, that's really surprising and I think very fun.
Yeah, credit to casting, actually, for putting him in there. Because I didn't expect to see his name come out.
Yeah.
And he's been really good. I think they were able to read a bit deeper into his character and they pulled it out. So he'd be one of my honorable mentions too.
Like, in terms of like him being a winner, a lot of that quirkiness was probably edited out because he had to be like the hero veteran who won. And without like, now that he's just one of many winners, like we can see more of like the funny side. And that is great. I wish they would edit winners to show that. I wish that's what we always wonder. Like, how would Tom from Survivor South Africa have been edited as the winner of a US Survivor season? And how are they, because they really try to smooth out the edges in a way Survivor South Africa doesn't in US Survivor. Like, they really try and make it neat narratives into the hero and like take away that color. And for Ben, I think they probably like they shaved the edges off. They made him a little bit more boring. And now we're seeing that he's like really fun.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of emphasis. Like, his one character moment was when the bamboo was cracking. And that was like the one reference point we had about Ben's character. And it was hard to sort of stray from that one moment.
Yeah, it was all
moment.
Really
but
very
people
dramatic.
Are complex.
Yeah.
And while that was a powerful moment, certainly it's one of the most powerful moments in the show's history. I think there's more to Ben that we're now seeing, which is really great.
Yeah.
So he'd also get an honorable mention from me. Absolutely. He's right up there. But for me, this week, I have to, like, very close to yours, Jeremy's going to get 3 points from me.
Mm-hmm.
And this is because Jeremy is sitting really pretty, considering the fact that in the first episode he was chopped off at the knees. I think the turnaround in his game has been miraculous, and I think he's just so cool. Like, he's such a dope character. He's taking it easy. He's not panicking. He's super calm. He's in control, and he is reaffirming my belief that he's a really good player in many complex and varying ways. And I think we might see that the community at large will buy into this idea that he is a standout, remarkable, maybe top tier winner at this point. So I think that he gets 3 from me for reaffirming that. And then obviously Michelle was fantastic. And I think that she's done a really great thing in that. First of all, her mission was to prove that she deserved to win. And I think this move has gone a long way to proving that. So I think that she definitely gets 2 because she is almost halfway there in terms of her own battle. You know, she's proven it to us certainly, and she will continue to do so throughout the season, I'm sure. So she's been really surprising and really fun to watch. She was a bit quiet in the previous episodes. I know she put out a funny tweet of her saying, like, I got hoodwinked when she mentioned that she was on the season of Survivor. That turned around beautifully in the last episode. And she's in a really great spot at this point. She's still not a big target. I don't believe she'll be one. And I think that she has managed to orchestrate something really cool. And then finally, because he is still there and he's still fighting and he can still live another day, Tony's going to get 1 from me. And that's because I think he's showing himself to be really vulnerable. He's showing himself to be a learning character. He's not presenting himself as being this expert on all things Survivor to his peers. He seems vulnerable, but he's close enough with people like Sarah that she relies on him to execute her plans, which is a unique position for him. It's very reminiscent of Kagiyan. In Game Changers, it was such a strong juxtaposition from his first game because there was just no one working with him. He was like ludicrous the whole way through. We are seeing a Tony that we last saw playing that season, and that's a very, very dangerous iteration of Tony. Of course, Boston Rob, I'm a huge fan of his work, and I think it's been an absolute treat watching him playing live. The last time I've never watched him play live before. I've always watched him play once he'd won or whatever, like 3 years later. So to see him playing live, playing under tough circumstances, and he's still there after 3 troubled consoles, you got to give him credit. He's an absolute legend, and he has earned the right to write a book about Survivor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he earned the statue. Like, really, they have. I agree. And I think, yeah, Jeremy Michelle really did win the week. But Tony, like, if Sarah can be his Trish, this is some legs. Like, Cops or Us can really do some stuff, which is, like, I don't even want to dare to dream because I'll be heartbroken, but I'm also excited by it. In this two-hour podcast, we have answered most of the questions that the listeners gave us. I will ask this from Edward Morris. He said, Mike, who would you have asked from your season to help you on a secret spy mission?
Jeff or Mubba, definitely. Yeah, Jeff and Mabba would have been the people that I would have worked with initially at La May and certainly off the merge. But then heading deeper on, yes, you knowing me, I probably would have asked like, yeah, I'm thinking about, I don't want to say alive, probably Rob, yeah. It would have been maybe Jacques, eh? Because Jacques was someone who never really had an issue with using advantages to get further in the game. And so he would have been more conducive to your working relationship. And also, I think that with me like and Jacques, had we been together earlier on in the game and had Jacques not been so closely tied to Sipe, I think we would have had a far more fruitful relationship because obviously Sipe was against me and she was with Jacques. So I think that would have been an opportunity for me to try and better relations with Jacques and hopefully swinging him around to my side. So that would have been my move in that instance.
And Jacques is someone who found an advantage that people carried to him while blindfolded, which is so much more interesting, I have to say, to me than the nighttime heist. Like, Stephen Fishback said this on Know It Alls. I'm in total agreement. I'm not into it. Like, it feels like the stakes are low. It's like, they're not going to wake up. They're used to people rattling around them because of the cameramen. Every time it cuts to them almost waking up, you know that's from like a different night. That's just like stock footage of them sleeping. Like, I just don't feel like, you know, there are stakes, and I would much rather spend the time rather than like, you know, the Tony stuff was incredible because Tony is just magic. But like Sarah digging around in the dark compared to any conversation between any combination of these people, I would choose the conversation. So I'm just not loving it. Also, it said on the advantage that if Sarah didn't get it, that if someone else on the other tribe just found it in the torches, they would have got to keep it. How unfair would that have been? Just like picking up your torches
and getting
an advantage. So I don't love it.
Yeah,
that is insane. Is anyone clamoring for these nighttime heists? Is that why we're watching Survivor for the heists? I'm not. Yeah.
Well, I guess in some ways, I suppose the Age of Extinction with the fire tokens has kind of transformed the nature of advantage acquisition, because sometimes, you know, in the past, like, people have acquired advantages through pretty absurd ways. If I think about the coconut that was placed near the tide when Carl found it in Everest Goliath. Yeah. That was a pretty absurd way to find an advantage. And I think that I'm not saying it's better or worse. I just think the nature of advantage acquisition is being changed by the fact that there are now fire tokens in the game. And
but
it's going to be
like,
interesting to see how that plays out.
It's like lengthened in terms of like, because now, like, you know, first Natalie has to find it and then Sarah has to go on a heist. It's like, this was a lot of time devoted to an advantage that'll probably be pretty useless. Australian Survivor does a bit of that as well, but they had like Pandora's box, like, but like that was pretty exciting, but it's like, this is going to end up being like completely irrelevant. Yeah. The amount of time devoted, and then they're still finding idols, and like, it's just, it is a lot of time. I like that the idols was kind of social. That would be to me like the best part of advantages. And that's why I really like the Sarah and Tony stuff, but just like these individual expeditions, it's not really that interesting to me. So
yeah,
we'll see. Mike, what is the hashtag? Now that we've finished the podcast, I only have one option. So I have hashtag eat my bee hat, which is, I think, like we should start saying in the Survivor community when we don't think something is going to happen. I will eat my little bee hat, but we'll just keep it at eat my bee hat.
I think we can run with that. Yeah, I'll eat the bee head. That's spot on. How did you think of that so quickly? I'm so impressed by you. When you said it, I was like, oh man, I wish I thought of that. That's amazing.
I write them down during the podcast. This is my job.
Very impressed. Very, very impressed.
It's a hard job. You have to remember to write hashtags while the podcast is going. It's important work. Someone's going to do it. Mike, where can people find you online to see any of your thoughts about this if you're tweeting about the show?
It's Mike V. That's It's Mike VEE on Twitter and on Instagram. So I'm there, and it's mostly radio stuff. It's not, I try and avoid being too Survivor-ish because I've got this horrible habit of like bringing Survivor into every conversation in my life. So I'm trying my best to like be a normal functioning human again.
What else do people talk about? I'm genuinely curious to know that. Like,
it's not a good look though. It's like, I can just tell, I like bore people out. I'm like, whenever there's an episode, that's aired, especially now, when is it war, I'll like walk into work and I'll be like edgy, and I'll be white in the face because I'm super pale from disappointment, and I'm like shaking, and people are like, what's wrong with you? It's my contracts. He seems unhinged. And all of a sudden I got to be like, explain that, you know, Ethan was blindsided. It's not a great look for me.
Well, I was just saying how I was talking about Ethan's whole history at my Friday night dinner with my in-laws last night. So you understand who I am as a person. and why I'm losing people I love. No, everyone's weirdly on board with it. I have some very supportive people in my life. Too supportive. Guys, pull me back.
They're really great
put
to
me in
be.
Check.
They're really, really nice to me. It's just like, I feel sorry for them always having to hear it. So like every time it rains, I'm just like, this is how it was in Samoa. Or like every time I'm hungry, I'm like, on Survivor, I was way hungrier than this. It's a real reference point in my life, and I've got to take it easy, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I've never been on and I still talk about it a ton. So like, you're fine. This is the safe space to talk about being that person. And speaking about how much you talk about Survivor, I've got all my plugs. So what do we got? Okay. Pia Miranda was my guest for Australian Survivor this week. Next week, I'll be talking to my Survivor South Africa co-host, Mike Bloom, about Australian Survivor. Week 4, Australian Survivor exit interviews. And obviously, the Survivor Global podcast. That's all at International Survivor Hap Up. So I hope you guys are subscribed. Thank you for all the positive feedback. Please do tell your friends, tell anyone, and just spread the word. That would be amazing. Talking Tribal is happening. I'm doing that for Australian Survivor. This week, the guest was Osha, who is the host of The Bachelor and The Masked Singer, which was really cool. Everyone should check that out. It's pretty fun every week. Very different doing TV, but fun. So I hope people are checking that out either as a show or as a podcast. Follow me at Shannon Gates. That's where you'll get all of this content. I post it all on Instagram and Twitter. Next week, we're not doing Survivor Global because I'm going on a cruise for 3 days with 23 members of my family. So I will not have access to my microphone and the internet. But the week after, for week 5, I'm also not doing Survivor Global, but I am doing something else, and that will be announced in due time. Stay tuned, because that's a bit of a surprise. But that's it. Mike, thank you so much for coming on, for deep diving all of this with me. And this is how we can get it out of our system, hopefully have some like regular conversations with people in our lives so that they don't want to stab us.
Thank you for having me, Shannon. And thank you for the community for listening in. That's been a real treat to be able to speak about the game that we all love so much.
I agree. Thank you so much to everyone for listening. Thanks again to you, Mike. Thanks to Scott St. Pierre behind the scenes. And I will see you next time. Bye.
Australian Survivor is saved.
Survivor New Zealand.
Adventure of a lifetime.
The adventure of a lifetime.